This is Batman. Comic Timing is a proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. It's what it does, because I'm Batman.
Welcome to episode 65 of Comic Timing, a comics podcast devoted to the average comic book fan from the average comic book fan. Joining in as Brett Cassino, rotating panel of guests, and myself, Ian Levitsy, discuss whatever comes to mind, time after time, here on Comic Timing. The other half of the comics cast, John Hook, the guys from Codename Hour, Brent and I talk about what happens behind the scenes of your comic books. That's right, we go into comic book theory on this episode. So what makes your favorite creative teams tick, and what makes certain transitions from comics to film work better than others? Here now, Comic Timing. Hey there, folks. My name's Ian Levinstein, and welcome to episode 65 of Comic Timing. We've got a nice packed house here, just like last time around, but let me introduce first. He's the co-host who is jonesing for more Lost, but is stuck on this fucking call instead. It's Brent Cassino. What's going on, Brent?
Fucking Lost had to change your time because of stupid Desperate Housewives and fucking Grey's Anatomy ruined our fucking podcast time. I should write a letter.
Dear ABC, stop having your shows during our podcasting time. Yes. Every person has a lot of podcasting time, and you're going into it. I hate you. Please die in a fire.
Fire.
All right. Well, also joined by, for the first time, John Hook from the, what should I say? You're from multiple podcasts, so which podcast should I say you're from?
Comics Cast.
All right. From the Comics Cast.
Comics Cast with a K.
Yeehaw.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you need to type up that letter and send it away to ABC.
Yes, I do. Well, I've had Bruce on before, so it's nice to have part two of the Comics Cast family on.
Cool. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Well, good to have you on. We're also joined by the MegaCon crew, who you heard from the MegaCon episode, Sean Cummings and Travis Earls, and also joined by their techie, who I'm not making this up, whose last name is Quick, Andrew Quick. So what's going on, guys?
How's it going?
Not much.
I'll take your cough as a hi.
Good call.
Well, good to have everybody on. It's been a while, at least in my mind.
Too long.
Yeah, I know. Damn it, I want to go back to MegaCon.
Hey, are you coming to Chicago?
I might be. If San Diego falls through, Chicago is my backup plan. If I did both, I'd be broke and living in a box.
Yeah, kind of what we're doing.
We will be too. Don't worry about it. We should share a box. It'll be nice.
Okay. There aren't boxes that big and cozy, so I'm going to have to pass.
Are you kidding? Have you ever seen a refrigerator box?
And now all I'm thinking of is Frisky Dingo, where...
I just saw that for the first time, like, last night.
Oh, really?
Yeah. On Wednesday nights, I hang out at the comic shop, and somebody said, put Frisky Dingo in. I was like, what is that? And so we played, like, I don't know, four or five episodes back to back. I was like, oh, my God, that is hilarious.
Was this starting at season one?
It started with Killface being introduced, and he had the twins, and he killed both of those guys. The one girl became a geisha.
Yeah, this is season one, so you're starting at the right spot. In season two, this isn't giving anything away because you'll have no idea why it's happening, but in season two, there's a presidential race going on, so even more fun happens.
Oh, my God.
But anyway. Now, before this episode begins, starting this episode, it was going to start next episode, but since this one took so damn long to come out, I figured I'd put it on this episode as well. Comic Timing as a sponsor. Yeah, that's right. And it's not New York Comic Con is bigger, better, and has double the space. Now we're done with that. No copy here. This is just off the top of our heads. Nice guff going out there. And we are indeed sponsored by Heroes Corner. I want to thank the guys over at Heroes Corner for doing so. You can find all their stuff over at heroescorner.com. And this month, you get to reap the benefits of us getting this deal. How do you do that? Well, let me explain it to you, all right? First off, if you've never been to Heroes Corner before, if this is your first time using Heroes Corner, use the promo code CTSAVES before you put in your order. Now, what that means is once you're done actually checking everything before you go to the checkout, do CTSAVES. You're going to get yourself 5% off your first order with Heroes Corner. So that's going to help you out a bit there. Number two, as of this month and for months after this, Comic Timing is picking three books to be our book of the month. What's this going to do? Well, you know, 22 pages, it's going to be a bit more than 22 pages from now on. I mean, we've done more than 22 pages before. Now we're going to do three books. That's going to be our once-a-month review episode. This is obviously starting in August because, well, that's 2 months after June. Hey. Now, the three books for this month are as follows. Amazing Spider-Man number 568, which is, of course, the first John Romita Jr. issue of Amazing Spider-Man with Dan Slott on writing. The diamond code is JUN082306 if you're looking for the diamond code. And this one, you're getting an additional 10% off on your order, so it's only going to cost you $2 to get Amazing Spider-Man number 568. Also, Booster Gold number 11, Chuck Dixon's fill-in issue, and one of the last stories he's going to be writing for DC for now. This is part one of his two-part Booster Gold fill-in. Diamond code of JUN080216, Booster Gold number 11. Yet again, you're going to receive an extra 10% off, so Booster Gold will only cost you $1.50 this month. And last but not least, Doctor Who the Forgotten, which is Pia Guerra's debut on the Doctor Who books. She's going to be doing this miniseries here, and obviously she did the art on Why the Last Man. So if you like Why the Last Man art, and you like Doctor Who, or even if you've never even checked out Doctor Who before, cough, cough, Brent, this might be the book for you. So the diamond code on this one is JUN084045, Doctor Who the Forgotten. You're also going to receive 10% off on this one, so it's only going to cost you $2. To receive these discounts, when you're all ready to put in your order, in the notes section, right before you do your final checkout, put Comic Timing Special Discount. That's how you're going to receive the extra 10% off on Amazing Spider-Man number 568, Booster Gold number 11, and Doctor Who the Forgotten number 1. So yet again, Comic Timing Special Discount is the code you put in the notes section of your order. Don't forget about that. And here is their official June promo along with this stuff. This month, they're giving discounts on all books with a powerful female lead. So that means stuff like Manhunter and Wonder Woman and so on and so forth. You're going to receive an extra 6% off right off the bat. No promo code needed on these to get yourself that extra discount. So it's going to be 46% off on all of these titles involving a strong woman. And that's obviously for Juno, the Greek goddess of women, for June. Doesn't that make sense? So go ahead and check out Heroes Corner. They've got the best customer service out there. And I thank them very, very much for sponsoring Comic Timing and for doing so in the foreseeable future. So we got ourselves a relationship here, guys. So go ahead and reap the benefits. We now return you to a regularly scheduled episode. Just about to start. We're going to be talking comic book theory on this episode, and I'm going to say actually straight from Sean's mouth via Skype exactly what we're talking about here. How ideas go from ideas to the page. The differences between cool stories and great stories. How artists affect writers and vice versa. And the topic that's been bugging me personally is how comics transfer mediums and how well they do it. Specifically, I guess, movie adaptations, how you take the idea from comics and adapt them for movies, how not everything transfers the right way. But I guess we'll start with John first because, well, he's the one person versus the three people. So, John, what makes a good comic book to you? I guess, how do you make a good comic book from idea to page?
From idea to page, you know, you've got to have some sort of concept that's going to have a universal effect that you'll be able to continue to build on, like a world that you can continue to go back to and get different stories from.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, just not one idea. There have to be multiple ideas in your head.
If it's a one trick pony, then that's it. You'll tell your one story and then it's dead. So you need to have a world that you can go back to. In my idea, something like Walking Dead, where Robert Kirkman put a world together that anything could happen. He can go back and continue to tell different stories. And I think we see that clearly as he'll get onto a particular arc, complete that arc, and then transition into the next arc. And it's set in that same world that he can go back to and tell a new aspect from it.
Kirkman's done that exceptionally well. In fact, I think really ever since the Image verse really started, back when you had the Wildstorm characters along with the Image characters, it's the first true universe we've had in Image Comics since the early days with Spawn, Wildcats, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he's building quite a world out there.
Yeah. All right, then I'll throw it all over here now to the Codename Power crew. I guess you can talk amongst yourselves and figure out who's going to answer first, but how do you go from idea to page in your minds? Whoever wants to tackle it first can go first and then just roll around the table.
As far as story goes, I don't think it's so much about the world as it is about the characters. What makes a story powerful is being able to relate to the characters. And like, you can make as real a world as you want if you can't have your characters being related to by your audience, you don't have anything. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's don't get me wrong, the world is just as important, but like if your characters can't tell a story, then you don't have anything.
Then you've just got pretty pictures on a page.
Again, it goes back to the difference between a cool story and a great story. You can have a cool story that has pretty people, but you're not going to have a great story. You know, like something that's going to be remembered.
Personally, I agree with Sean. Like, I'm a bigger fan of good characters than a good plot when it comes to story. Like, there's a lot of stories that I like that other people didn't like because they're like, oh, I didn't like the story. But to me, it had great characters. And ultimately, if the story could be weak to me, as long as I care about the characters, I don't care if they're having, you know, if they're needing to run from the law for their lives or having trouble fucking playing hopscotch. If the character's interesting, like, that's why I like Kevin Smith movies. Nothing major happens, but the characters are cool. That's why I like Quentin Tarantino movies. The characters are always interesting. You know, it doesn't really matter what the plot is. Like, I like the lives of the characters are interesting to me.
So I guess it's sort of, I guess you could maybe bring up Seinfeld as an example. You know, how it could be a world about nothing, but as long as you present people you can relate to, then you're good to go.
Yeah, Seinfeld's a good example, too. I mean, I am a fan of, you know, like, I guess devices in stories, as far as, like, individual things. Like, I don't tend to come up with a overall, like, really good story until I start putting the little pieces together, like, the cool moments that I know of, you know, that I think of, and seeing how they fit together and come up with a bigger picture. So I'm not really the best one to talk about story as a whole myself, but, like, I really like thinking about how characters react to situations and putting them into the situation, and then just kind of seeing how it plays out from there.
Right. Andrew, you got anything to add?
Prime example of how it's done wrong is the new Heroes for Hire book. I mean, I can stare at those pages all day long with the girls that are in there, but I could care less about what's happening to them.
It's the exact reason why I dropped the book.
There you go.
Well, it's funny, too, because, like, when it first started out, I'm like, well, how could you go wrong? I mean, you've got strong female characters there, you know, like Misty Knight and Black Cat. And you've got, you know, a couple characters that are sort of new to me. And you've got the idea of Heroes for Hire, but there was just absolutely no substance to the book whatsoever. Like, after reading three issues, I think maybe three things happened in those three issues. And I just, like, sat there thinking, what the hell am I reading?
Yeah, definitely. No, I'm a diehard Spider-Man fan. So, you know, anything with the Black Cat in it, I'm going to at least open up the pages. So I gave it a chance. I looked at the pretty pictures and immediately set it back down.
Right. Brent, we'll throw it over to you. What makes a good comic book good in your eyes?
Good writing and good art, and you have to have a decent story to have good writing, you know. I think it just takes a good idea, for one, and then I think the execution of the idea helps a whole lot when you're writing the comic book story.
Now, are you going more along the lines of what Sean said, where the characters are more important than the overall story?
I don't know about the characters so much to say that the actual story has to have an interesting idea. You can have the best characters ever, but, I mean, like, to me, Batman is a great character, one of the best ever, but not every Batman story is good. You know, the character's good, but the way the story is and the plot of it and how he's written makes a great Batman story. It's not just the character. Anybody can write a Batman story, but only a few people can write a great one, which includes the handling of the character, the plot of the story, and, like, how they execute it and how they execute their ideas.
Well, that actually brings up a good point, because Batman has been portrayed so differently over the years, where the character has adapted and shifted, from story arc to story arc. Like, maybe one story arc you'll get, like, a brooding, dark Batman that barely ever goes out during the day, and then the next writer takes over, and all of a sudden Bruce Wayne's back in the picture, and you're seeing both dual sides of the character, and, you know, he's hanging out with Dick and Tim all over again. So, I mean, you can go from, there are, like, seven different Batman out there, almost, when it comes to stories and characters.
If I can interject here, with those really heavy, iconic characters, you really can't use those as a gauge, because they've been around so long that they really are multiple characters. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen so many different sides of Superman. You've seen the Savior. You've seen the Boy Scout. You know, the husband, the angry, you know, almost godlike. You're going to get as good as the writer's going to give. And I don't know. It's really hard to see, engage, like, other characters to, like, Batman, Superman, Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. You know, these things.
Okay, well, let's go with, like, why, though. Those have some great characters, but that has to do with the story, and that's one consistent vision of the characters over a 60-issue run. You know, if it was any other person, maybe those characters in that story might not have been great, thus weakening the comic.
Well, I think that's how those
characters have proven themselves as over time, as fans have interacted with those characters, and then creators have come on board to pick them up and try and take their spin at it. I think there's a reason why characters like Superman and Batman have, Spider-Man, Wolverine, you know, have risen to the top as far as being popular and versatile and being able to tell a variety of stories, is because those characters, the strength of those characters, have shown that we're able to put them in a variety of situations and have them come out and tell good stories. Whereas some characters don't have as much versatility, and I don't understand why. A character like Moon Knight, I think, could be as versatile as Batman. I mean, it's practically the same character, yet he isn't, you know?
Right, right. What were you guys going to say over there at the Peanut Gallery?
I was going to say, like, I agree, like, you know, personally I'm a huge Batman fan, but, you know, there's definitely Batman stories I don't like. But that's definitely in the hands of the writer. I don't think that's so much a fault of the character, as no matter what, especially with something like Batman or any character that's been around that long, you're going to get bad writing on it. And ultimately, you're not looking at the same character. It's like if you give, like I was saying, Quentin Tarantino earlier, if you give the whole storyline to somebody else and tell them to make, like, a Pulp Fiction 2, mm-hmm. and even if it's including the same characters, you're not going to get the same story. You know, you're probably not going to care about the characters as much because somebody else is going to write it completely different. And although you're working with the same characters, it's not really the same character.
Well, actually, that brings up a good point, because if you look at, say, for example, Runaways, you know, that was a story that was started by Brian K. Vaughan, and he obviously had his idea of what those characters were like. And then Joss Whedon came on, and although they're still basically the same characters, there have been some personality shifts within the book. And I'm sure that there are going to be a hell of a lot more personality shifts as, if memory serves me right, Terry Moore is the next person who's taking over. And, you know, Humberto Ramos is going to be on art, so they're even going to have a little bit of a different look to them. So I'm not quite certain if it's going to be even the same book that I started with when I started reading Runaways. For all I know, I'm going to enjoy it and all that, but it's going to be essentially a totally different book than it was when it first started with Brian K. Vaughan.
What are we arguing here? Are we arguing what makes a good comic or good characters? Because I got lost there.
it's a little bit of both, actually, because, you know, I mean, with the good characters, you lead to good comics, you know? So I guess we're sort of talking both here with this particular topic. So, I mean, unless I myself am off base here, I mean, did I lose the conversation somewhere? Or?
I would definitely say what makes a good book is the diversity of the character, because, I mean, can't remember who exactly said it, but when you were talking about, you know, Wolverine and Spider-Man and all those different characters, I mean, those characters are so diverse that you could put them in any setting. You could have them do anything in any story, and more than likely it's going to be good. But if you have a character that's very two-dimensional, prime example, let's say, I don't know, Venom. You know, he's had his own books before. Most of them have been crap because yes. He's a two-dimensional character, and he's not intriguing as not as much as a lot of people think he is, I guess. You can't really give a good book with him because he's not going to drive the story. I mean, you could have a tremendous writer, but if they can't do anything with the character, the book is going to go nowhere because the story went nowhere.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask a question here that's sort of related to that. And I'll go around the round table to, you know, find out what everybody thinks. But do you have to like the main character of a book for the book itself to be enjoyable to you? I'm going to give up an example here, and I know that we mentioned before that, you know, mentioning Batman is probably not the best way to go, but I'm going to bring up All-Star Batman and Robin here. A lot of people that I've talked to about the book say, and specifically I'm even thinking of Sean Whalen of Raging Bullets when I think of this, that he himself has said he enjoys the title, he enjoys the rest of the characters of the book, but dear God, he cannot stand Batman in that book. He thinks he's a total prick. And, you know, and yet he still continues to pick up the title and enjoy everything else, but any scene with Batman in it just absolutely, you know, it's just against the grain for him. Now, you could say that this is because he's used to Batman being one way and all that, but we just got into that before. That can happen. So let's just think of it in general here. As a main character, do you have to like a main character of a book for that book to be successful? Going along the lines of comic book theory, what makes a book work? Actually, let's start with Brent here.
I certainly don't think you do. I mean, like, any Punisher book, I don't like the guy, but I'm enjoying Punisher War Journal just because of, Matt Fraction's take on it. And I'm enjoying Batman and Robin, even though I don't necessarily like Batman. But I'm enjoying seeing his journey from that asshole prick, you know, super dick that he is, to what's going to become my Batman, you know, which is the one everyone loves.
That has to be a separate title. We need to start that, Asshole Prick Super Dick.
No, but like,
would he be the goddamn gumshoe?
I know. I don't know.
God damn it!
It'll be on tomorrow.
Did you guys just realize you're missing Lost?
No,
no, I was just saying it.
Oh, okay, okay.
Sean thinks he's funny.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
I am funny. God damn it!
Was there anything else you wanted to add, Brent, or was that the end of your train of thought?
Yeah, I lost it.
Okay, well, no, you're talking about not liking the Punisher but enjoying the book.
I don't know.
Okay. God damn it. All right, fine. Then you know what? I'll head over to John with the same question.
I'm sorry about that, Brent. I didn't mean to throw you off. I'm experiencing not really liking a character but getting drawn into a book with Ghost Rider. Jason Aaron's take on Ghost Rider. I've just never really cared for the character and never had any kind of appeal to me, even, you know, I guess back when he had his heyday. I know Jason Aaron, and so he kind of berated me and talked me into picking up this title and checking it out. And I'm liking it. I can't believe I'm actually liking Ghost Rider, and I'm liking the story. So, I mean, I normally only pick up titles that I already have an interest in that character. So this is interesting for me to be reading Ghost Rider.
So it's really the first time it's ever really happened to you?
Yeah. I mean, if it's a pre-existing character and it's getting a new title, you know, I've got something to fall back on. Mm-hmm. and know whether or not I want to pick up that title. If it's a brand new title with brand new characters, I'll usually give it a shot, and if it's, you know, one or two issues, that's it. If it was good enough, I might stick with it. If not, I've made my decision. I'll drop the title. So when Ghost Rider was coming out, I was like, well, okay, you know, great. But I checked it out, and it's actually pretty good. So I'm quite surprised that I'm liking Ghost Rider.
That's how I was at first with Moon Knight when the new series first came out. And for a while there, I was actually picking it up and enjoying it, even though I wasn't really that huge a fan of Moon Knight, or as I like to call him, if Batman wore white, because that's pretty much all he is. Silver, if you ask certain people. But after a while, even though I was enjoying the story, he wasn't leaving his damn house. You know, and it just got to me enough where I just stopped picking up the book. And I'm not even sure if the story itself lost me. It was just going slow enough where, because I didn't love the character in the first place, I stopped picking up the title. But, you know, maybe I'll pick it up again in trade and I'll think differently. But it did actually grate on me after a while, not liking the character and his slowness and not leaving the house. let's throw it over to Travis first, and then we'll go Andrew and then Sean. Do you need to like a main character to enjoy a book?
I don't think you have to, especially if they have a strong supporting cast, because there's definitely been books that I didn't necessarily not like the main character, but I just thought all the other characters in the book are better.
And so, you know, I was more interested in reading about the supporting cast than I was the main character. Even though, like I said, I may not have necessarily not liked the character, they were the least, you know, popular part of the book for me. Mm-hmm. And then, especially in, I mean, it might be a little different in team books, but there's, you know, team books definitely have their hierarchy where you're supposed to like this character more than this one. And actually, a lot of times in team books, I don't like the ones you're supposed to, that are supposed to be like the public favorite or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like reading the other ones because, you know, they put a lot more into the supporting characters, I think, and building the character them. And I like just try to keep, I guess, the main character at, hey, I'm the badass superhero and I punch things real hard. Then you're just like, you know, good for you. You punch things a lot. Whoop-de-doo. This guy over here, however, he's funny. I like him.
So I guess you're an Aquaman fan.
That's low. Yeah.
Hey, it had to be said. I'm sorry. The minute that he said, like, you know, and I like the characters and nobody's not really supposed to like, and then I don't like the characters the people are supposed to like. So right away, I think of the Justice League, where you've got, you know, you got Superman, you got Batman, you got Wonder Woman, you even got Martian Manhunter, and then you've got Aquaman. He talks to fish.
I gotta say, like, on that, not trying to defend myself, like, Aquaman is one of those characters that's so bad. Generally, when I'm trying to, like, name off the big seven to people, he's the seventh one because I always forget he's on the team.
And at least for now, in that big seven, he's not there.
Yeah, and, you know, not really a problem with that.
All right, Andrew, you're up.
I'm definitely going to say no, you don't have to like the characters to read the book, because I hate Tony Stark. I hate him with such a passion that I want to punch him in his throat. Not even when he's in the suit, because I'd break my hand. I just want to punch him in the throat.
Him. Iron Man is a douche.
Exactly.
Watch your words, son.
I love
That's why I'm here in Brooklyn, man. You can't punch me through the internet.
Yet. They're working on that.
Sean's way too technologically unadvanced to do that.
No, but like I can't stand Tony Stark. I love the Iron Man book. I'll read it every time it comes up. I hate Scott Summers, but I love the way they write him in, you know, X-Men. I can't stand the bastard almost as much as Tony Stark. But so no, you don't have to like the character to read the book. I think sometimes, you know, a strong dislike for a character will make you read the book because you want something terrible to happen to them.
Okay, has everybody here read Secret Invasion number 1?
Yes.
Yep.
No? Okay. Do you mind if I spoil?
No.
Do you mind if I spoil?
Spoil away.
Okay.
Spoil away.
Okay. In Secret Invasion number 1, we're hinted at the fact that Jean Grey / Phoenix might be one of the ones that is coming back. Because, you know, there she is in the group of people that got off of the ship and all that. For the love of God, let it be a Skrull. Okay? I've been hinting at the fact that it might not be a Skrull, that maybe they'll explain that's why, you know, Jean Grey has died so many frickin' times, because she's just been replaced by other Skrull duplicates over the years. But if you bring Jean back, and then you have Scott go back to Jean, there goes all my like of the character, because he's become a fun character with Emma.
Yeah, okay, definitely.
I do want to say this. I thought the baby was Jean. You guys did read.
Yes.
Like the, okay.
Yeah, they've been hinting at that. They've never actually said it. I actually think it's Rachel.
It's what?
I think it's Rachel.
Why do you think it's Summers, though?
No, I think it's Rachel Summers because it'll look and the hair and the eyes match Rachel as well, and it would explain away her alternate future birth and all that crap. You know? No, she wasn't actually born in the future. She was born in our time, brought to the future. So she's not actually related to Scott. She's not actually Scott and Jean's kid. She was just told that, you know, in her future upbringing.
That's actually very similar to my theory on the baby.
Okay, but anyway, yeah, just going back to what I was saying, Scott makes Emma a good character. Jean does not.
I would definitely agree with you, especially in the last issue of X-Men Legacy, where they were she basically looked at him and she's like, yeah, face it, you wanted to be a damn dirty hippie. That was one of the best lines I've ever heard come from.
You mean Uncanny X-Men, right?
Yeah.
Uncanny.
All right, and moving over to Sean here.
Who likes Tony Stark?
Yeah, by the way, I do like Tony Stark.
Hey, I liked him in the movie.
Yeah, you start liking him more. No, I go back and forth on this issue. When I pick up a book, First, I have to explain something about myself. I read much more sporadically than everybody else. I usually don't read issues as they come out. I usually wait for trades. And even then, like, I just kind of randomly pick stuff up. So, like, when I pick up a book, it's usually from the main character. Mm-hmm. And if I don't like the main character, it better have a damn good supporting cast. But I agree with everybody else about the whole Jean Grey thing and the Scott, man. Scott is a good character with Emma. And I love Emma Frost, too. So that, like, just goes really well. But the X-Men is one of those books that you can have good characters elsewhere, and it's still a good book.
Right.
But, like, if you're going to read Hulk, Hulk better be a damn good character. And or Thor. Thor right now. Mm-hmm. Perfect example.
Actually, I don't know. I got to say, in response to the Thor, you actually let me borrow that issue 6. Thor didn't show up in that shit till the end. I thought it was a great issue. Like, you didn't even need Thor in his own fucking book, and it was still a good issue.
Yeah, well, actually, J. Michael Straczynski has managed to craft a really decent supporting cast.
Yeah, and I mean, that's my point. Like, not only do you not have to like the main character, fucker doesn't have to be in the book.
Well, but the issue 6 was the only one like that.
Okay.
Like, every other issue, he has been, you know, there. And it's been about him and Donald Blake and their interaction, and it's been very good.
Okay, well, then you know what? How about this for an example? What about a Daredevil book? And this has happened a lot during its most recent run with Marvel Knights, where you mostly see Foggy and the rest of the supporting cast, but you only maybe see 3 or 4 pages of Daredevil himself, Matt Murdock. That's it. And you get the rest of the cast. And there have been a bunch of issues, both during Bendis' run and Brubaker's run, where, you know, we haven't really seen that much Daredevil, and it's still been a good book. Mostly because the supporting cast has been crafted so well, you do not need Matt Murdock to make that book good.
The Daredevil, I did read some of the stuff, especially during Bendis' run, and I agree, don't necessarily need Matt Murdock. I'm not as big a fan of Foggy as a lot of people are. You know, he's there, and that's cool, whatever, but I'm not a huge fan of him. All in all, though, with Bendis, I don't know, he could write a story about, like, the missing piece of shit, and I think it'd be interesting. Bendis is amazing in whatever he does. So, I mean, he's a pretty good example to use. Like, if you have a question on can it be done, let Bendis write a story, and we'll see.
Flip a coin and give him a character.
Yeah, pretty much. Be like, hey, Bendis, is it possible to not have a character in a book and still have a good book using their supporting cast? And then he'll write an issue, and you'll be like, well, fuck, yes, it is.
And he just could write out how I die a horrible, gruesome death and tell me that, you know, if I read it, it'll happen. I'll read it. He's that good a writer.
That's great. Wow.
New Avengers 26 and the most recent one had that Hawkeye issue. He wasn't in New Avengers up until then.
Mm-hmm.
And the most recent one with the Skrull Queen, that was a good issue. No cast in it.
Well, hell, for that matter, how about the last 2 issues of Mighty Avengers where it's been all Nick Fury?
Yeah. He's not even in the mic.
Go Nick Fury.
Yeah.
How many issues of Captain America have we had without a Captain America?
Thank you.
Wait. I've got one better for it.
Okay.
Cable and Deadpool.
Yes. Cable was not in the last 15 issues of Cable and Deadpool.
Yeah, but who cared about Cable in the first 30 issues of it anyway?
Yeah, you're reading it for Deadpool.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was. Well, the best part of it too is that most of the time it would even the trade dress would say Cable and Deadpool, and then Cable's name would be crossed out, and they would write either, like, you know, Spider-Man or Fantastic Four or Doctor Strange or whoever happened to be guest starring in that issue on the trade dress itself. So it basically became Deadpool team up.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got it all out in a trade paperback right now. It's just called Daredevil versus the Marvel Universe.
And we all know
it's
Daredevil.
It's not like
wins.
He makes friends.
Yeah, and I just said Daredevil again. Deadpool, yes. No, he doesn't have any friends at all other than... not even his supporting cast are his friends.
Bob,
okay.
Bob likes him.
Well, Bob likes him because he gives him health insurance.
Let's face it, that's important.
Yeah, well, and come on, with Bob the Hydra agent, it's great, because why is he a member of Hydra? Because of the health insurance. That's it. He's not an evil dude. They offered him health insurance. He put on the green tights.
I think he's lying. He just really wanted the green tights.
I think he's a Skrull.
Uh-oh. Bob the Skrull?
No Skrull. Oh, no more Skrull.
We're all Skrulls. We just don't know it.
We'll lose the comic book topic real quick if we get on Who's Skrull.
Uh-oh. Look out, look out. All right, you know what? Let me steer it back then. Here's a question for Travis, Mr. Artist. Have there been books where you've been enjoying the book itself, you've been enjoying the parts of the book, and then they change the artist, and all of a sudden it's not the same book to you? Even though the characters are still the same, even though the writer is still the same, the book just does not gel with you anymore. Has that happened, and is there a way to avoid that with a change in artist?
As far as keeping the writer but changing the artist, the book that really stood out to me was actually the Batman Superman book that was coming out. Mm-hmm. I really liked the first two story arcs, the one with Ed McGuinness, the one with Mike Turner. Even though, like, over the years I've been losing favor with Mike Turner, but I liked the way that it was presented there.
Minus emaciated Supergirl.
Yeah. But that third story arc that came out with them in the future, like, I don't know. I guess it was a mix. Like, I didn't really like the story itself, but it was still Jeff Loeb. So, you know, ultimately the level should still be there in the writing. But, like, the art just wasn't there anymore because they got, you know, like, top-tier artists for it. So it was, like, you know, big deal book, and then it's like they just lost out. And then as far as, like, changing teams, but you're keeping the same book and characters and all that, the Ultimates most recently, like, I really liked Hitch's art and Miller's writing, and I've been a big fan of the Ultimates. And now it's like, and despite the fact that I'm a really big fan of Joe Madd, his stuff just does not go with that book, and it totally throws me off.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm actually a big proponent of this, and we mentioned it on the last episode of Comic Timing, that there should be black and white variants of this Ultimates run, because the coloring just ruins the entire book.
Yeah, I am a big fan of Joe Madd's pencils, and I do think, like, the way that a lot of his line work's colored over kind of loses it. And if they did put out just, like, the black and white version, probably would have some. But still, to me, the Ultimates, like, a big part of it was the fact that the art made it so realistic looking. It was like, you know, hey, if I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, I would run into Captain America.
Right.
But, like, now you're like, hey, Clint Barton looks like Garrison. That's pretty awesome.
Should have put Mike Deodato in that book.
Just, like, toss Joe Madd back on Battle Chasers, bring Brian Hitch back to Ultimates, except make sure he actually hits the deadline for once, and we'll be good to go.
Yeah. Brent, say that again. We kind of lost you there.
Said, put Mike Deodato back on Ultimates. He's got that same kind of look, that super realistic type.
Yeah, I mean, we could do that. Like, just anybody. I mean, anybody that's in, like, that, what I like to call, like, dynamic realism style. Put anybody like that on that book, and you'll be good to go. But when you go totally off kilter to somebody that does, like, you know, the fantasy or manga or anything like that, you're going to lose the feel of the book, even though, you know, the story could be right up there with trying to keep everything realistic, or as realistic as, you know, talking about alien invasions and guys that grow, like, the size of 10-story buildings and shit when they get pissed off can be. You lose that thing. It's kind of like with Alex Ross. Any book he gets on, it adds a whole new level of realism to it. You know, like, that's what really got me about Kingdom Come. Mm-hmm. With Mark Waid and Alex Ross, it was a great, you know, it was a great story. It was a very realistic story for superheroes with very realistic art, and, you know, for a while, that was my number one book.
Yeah, well, just as long as you don't go as realistic as, say, like, a Greg Land, where his idea of realism is taking, you know, pictures of models from Playboy and putting them as the characters. That's not the sort of realism I want.
I think
I wouldn't mind it if, like, the book he was drawing was, you know, like, Lady Death or something that I didn't give a fuck about the story anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, if I was just looking for the scantily clad women, go for it. But, you know, yeah, you're right. When you're trying to read, like, the Supreme Power, or the Ultimate Power thing, mm-hmm. which I really like Ultimate Power because I'm a big fan of Supreme Power. Yeah, and you're just like, okay, these girls have a lot of orgasms. Good.
Well, actually, going along the lines of the question that I just asked, I'll give you an example with Land that sort of threw me off a little bit. And even with this Free Comic Book Day issue of Uncanny that just came out, Uncanny X-Men.
That was pretty good. I enjoyed that. I don't usually like Greg Land.
It's good, but what took me out of it is just how different Pixie looked. Because up until now, she's looked like a Pixie. You know, she's had these huge eyes, and she's had this, you know, girlish look to her. And then all of a sudden, Greg Land's drawing her.
Scotty Young?
Scotty Young was drawing her. Ramos was drawing her. Yeah, no.
Ramos did a very good job on X-Men.
To a point. Yeah, he drew some characters better than others. But, yeah.
I love his art.
Yeah. No, I like his art too. I just thought that some characters looked a little bit too off for my taste. But anyway, let's go to John with the previous question. Have there been instances where you've been enjoying a title until an art change, even though the writing and the characters are still the same?
Going back to Walking Dead, that was a great title when Tony Ward started on it. It's a title that attracted me also just due to the setting and the characters that are in there. But when it changed over and it became Charlie Adler's art, that was very jarring. And it got to the point where I was considering dropping the book. But thankfully, that artist, I think got stronger, even though he's a veteran artist and very accomplished artist. I think this was a different type of book for him to illustrate. And I think it took him a few issues to kind of get his legs. But I think he's doing a great job now. But yeah, when they changed the artist on that title, that was very jarring, and it was almost enough to make me drop the title. I'd be interested to see if it did affect the sales.
Yeah, I think Walking Dead actually is still one of the few titles that has had an increase every single month. And I could be wrong on that, but as up until recently, I remember that they kept on pointing that out, that most titles have a downward incline once they start, but Walking Dead seemed to just keep on getting more and more people to the book. So I don't know if that's still the case. All right, but let's go to Brent with the question.
For me, like, I've been loving Green Arrow, Black Canary, and I've talked to Ian about this before. I don't know if it was on a podcast or what. But Mike Norton has recently come on the book, and I just feel like it's not his best work. Like, he's aping Cliff Chang. And I was reading the Blue Beetle issue that just came out, number 26, which I hated and loved at the same time because I don't know Spanish, and I had to flip to the back for every single word balloon, but that's a whole different thing. But his art in there was great. It looked like his own style. It looked, it didn't look like he was aping Raphael Albuquerque. It just looks like good Blue Beetle art or whatever. I loved it. But then I went back and looked at his Green Arrow Black Canary stuff, and it seems so much flatter to me and less rendered and less detailed. And I don't know, I'm just not in love with the stuff he's doing on Green Arrow Black Canary. And that's just for one issue. He may do it differently next time, but for what he's put out so far, I'm not in love with it.
So it's taking you out of the book?
It is taking me out of the book because I'm not expecting Cliff Chang. I'm expecting Mike Norton. And when Mike Norton gives me Cliff Chang, it takes me out. And when I know that he's the new regular penciler on the book, that's what ruins it for me. See, if it was like a guest penciler, like Ryan Benjamin did the latest issue of Batman, and he's kind of similar to Tony Daniel, but he's got his own taste,
Yeah.
And I'd read him in the Ra's al Ghul storyline, and so I know what he looks like, but he's not so – his style is similar to Tony Daniel's in a way. So that the change in art didn't take me out of the book if I was reading it from issue to issue. Whereas if Mike Norton filled in for Tony Daniel, then that'd be a different story.
Right, and well, that actually, to me at least, that's the difference between a fill-in artist and a new artist on a book. Because obviously if you are just filling in for one issue and then Tony Daniel's going to jump back on, they're going to try and get an artist that's as similar to Tony Daniel as possible so that not that many people are too jarred by it.
But that's what I don't understand with the Mike Norton and the Green Arrow Black Canary thing is that he's the new regular artist, so why is he, aping Cliff Chang, in my opinion anyway. He could be doing something however he wants, but that's just in my opinion that he's doing that.
No, I forget from our conversation, is there a new colorist and inker on the book as well, or is it just an entirely new team?
Cliff Chang did his own inks, and I think Wayne Faucher is inking Mike on this book.
Okay.
But what's disappointing for me is that, everybody on CGS loves Mike Norton, and I've never picked up new X-Men or, never really paid attention to his work because I wasn't already getting the books, and I don't have the budget to do it. Mm-hmm. And I did read Gravity, and I did like that stuff there, but I'm waiting for something to make me fall in love with him like everyone else is. So yeah, I'm just disappointed in that respect, I guess.
Right. I'm crossing my fingers because I'm hoping for the best. But another example that I'll give here – and it's kind of funny because I think it kind of actually helped me more than hurt me here. But Daniel Acuna started off with this new run of The Flash. And then you got a major shift in art because when you go from Daniel Acuna to Freddie E. Williams, their styles are night and day. Completely different style of art. And it was
painted to regular art, basically.
Right. And it's in the middle of an arc as well. It wasn't like the end of the arc, we're switching over. This was in the middle of the arc. So it was a little bit jarring, but at the same time, I think it kind of helped me because I was looking at art that was more appealing to my eye. Even though I liked the Daniel Acuna stuff, I kind of enjoyed Freddy's style a little bit more than I was enjoying Daniel's stuff, so I think it kind of helped me in the end. Now, I guess we'll give that reverse there. How weird is it to go from an artist that you're not enjoying to an artist that you're enjoying on a book? And I guess does that change the overall feel? Even going with the original question of even if you have the same writer here, changing artists to an artist that's, I guess, more appealing, that just adds to the overall experience of the comic book itself, I guess, right?
I would say so. I'm going to point out Teen Titans. They had Tony Daniel and then put Albert Nuevo on, who I absolutely abhor. And then they had a couple guest writers. They announced like a couple of these anime-styled guys as like the new regular penciler, but they only did one issue each. And then they got Eddie Barrows, and I fell in love with the book all over again just because of the way he draws the Titans and stuff, and I'm really enjoying his work. So, you know, but it was sad that he had to leave Countdown to Adventure for this book, but I'm loving his work on Titans, so... It is nice to have an artist that you like change your feeling for the book.
And
that was at the point where I was going to drop Teen Titans. And then Eddie Barrows came on and the story picked up and it saved it for me.
Right. Go ahead, Sean.
That's actually happened a couple of times with X-Men for me. Because, over the last few years, there's been so many artists that have bounced around on all the different X-Men titles. And... I can honestly say just across the board, anytime an artist comes to a book that I'm reading that I already – like the artist I already like, of course it's going to make it better to read. You know, it's like not only am I getting a good story, it's, oh, wow, now the guy that I really like is drawing it also, you know? So
it's like when Jim Lee does anything.
It's actually a very good point.
Well, see that it's funny that you mentioned that though, because that's not always the case with Jim Lee. There have been a few instances here and there when I think that's actually taken me out of the art because of the style that Jim Lee has. When I was reading the Stormwatch trades, when Warren Ellis was doing Stormwatch back in the day, and all of a sudden you went from I forget who the original artist was. I think it was actually. Who did Outsiders for a while with Winnick when that series first started up?
Tom Rainey.
Oh,
yeah,
man,
Rainey. There we go. Yeah, Tom Rainey. Tom Rainey was the artist, and then you went to Jim Lee for the end of an arc, and I was like, okay, this is kind of weird, you know. I mean, even though I'm a fan of Jim Lee's art, it was just such a total style shift that it took me out. So not always a good thing with Jim Lee.
I beg to differ, but that's personal. I mean, not that his stuff's always 100%, but like I just really like seeing his art on things.
Right. I just like seeing his art on things that I think he's made for, you know, or things that he's at least started.
Yeah, I do have to agree with the overall idea, though, that I don't think any artist should step in at the end of a story arc and finish it. Like, if you have an artist building up a story arc, you finish the story arc with that artist. You know, it helps retain that feel. Like even if you're gonna upgrade artists, like, you know, I don't know, if you've done three quarters of the story with one guy, go ahead and finish off the last quarter of that story arc, you know, just keep that feel of the whole thing.
Yeah. John, how jarring is it for you when an artist steps in near the end of a story arc?
It can be very jarring, but I have started reading a title because an artist that I like has joined that title, Action Comics. I just really enjoyed Frank Quitely's work, and so when he started doing Action,
you mean All Star?
All
Star Superman?
Action. Well, I'm reading All Star.
Okay, because Action right now is Frank, if memory serves me right.
Gary. Yeah, that's right. Gary Frank.
Gary Frank.
That's who I meant. Yeah. Yes, Gary Frank.
Okay.
And I know people. You know, some people don't like the surprise eyes, but I think it adds an element, you know. Gary Frank.
It's funny though, because when I look at Gary Frank's earlier stuff and I look at now, it's like somebody totally different is drawing the faces. You know, like his earlier stuff. And I still am a fan of Gary Frank. I'm liking his stuff. It's just that I've seen like his early Catwoman stuff, I think it was, and you compare it now to what he's doing on Action, and it seriously looks like someone else is just drawing the faces for him. The rest of the body looks perfectly the same, but the faces are a lot more rendered now than they used to be.
Yeah, there is. I think I have seen a difference as well. Unfortunately, for a long time, a lot of his characters, male and female, were all looking the same. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah,
but
now they just have the surprise eyes.
Yeah, now it's just down to the eyes, huh?
Oh man! All right, Brent, you had something to add?
Yeah, I wanted to say about losing an artist. What Sean and Travis were saying about. If the artist has done 3/4 of that arc, just let him finish it out. Don't trade him off. And the thing that stands out for me is the Under the Hood arc. The second they had the first trade, it was all Doug Monke. Great stuff. I think he did like 1 or 2 issues on the second trade, or the second like last 6 issues of the story, because it was a 12-parter. And then like the last 2 or 3 was Eric Battle. And he went from great art to horrible art. And it made me not enjoy the story as much because I couldn't stand Eric Battle. And this is before he did Tales of the Unexpected or whatever, and did some great stuff there, but what he did on Batman was not pretty at all.
Yeah. No, I'll agree with that, yeah. It was kind of a bit weird, and also yet another one of those style shifts when you go from I guess the grittier style of a Mankey over to Battle. It just doesn't really work. Anyway, so this brings me to another question along the same lines of this. Do an artist and a writer have to be a team, completely on the same page, in order to put out a perfect comic book to you? And this is totally along the lines of comic book theory, because I guess, it's 1 + 1 = 2 here. If an artist does just come on to a title for maybe 1 or 2 and then throws it off, then, obviously you're going to get something different. But do an artist and a writer have to be a team in order for a comic to be the perfect comic for you? And we'll start with Andrew, because he hasn't actually started anything yet.
I would say definitely yes. There's a lot of times where an artist's work kind of overshadows the writer. And, you can definitely see it there in multiple cases. I can't really bring up any, and you won't hear me say names because I'm terrible with names. There's a lot of times where I seriously see the work of the writer is kind of set off to the side, and he definitely had an idea when he was, putting the words on the page. And when the artist got a hold of it, they put their own spin on things and completely changed it around. A writer could have an action planned out and everything and explained, but if the artist isn't on the same page as them, they might take it a different way and draw it a different way. And it may not have the flow that the writer originally put on the paper. And the words will start to clash with the panels. Mm-hmm. If they're not working together, the comic book doesn't come together. It's going to fall apart. Because, people don't read comics for words. They don't read comics for pictures. They're reading it for both, the whole experience. So if they're not working together, then, yeah, you're not getting the whole experience.
Yeah, and sometimes even if an artist and a writer are a team, that artist doesn't even have to draw the issue in order for it to be perfect. And I'll give you an example here, The Boys. There have been some issues of The Boys that Derek Robinson hasn't done full art on. He'll do breakdowns or something like that, and there are 1 or 2 issues where I think he didn't even do breakdowns for, but he was still there for the process, giving his ideas, giving his thoughts. So Ennis and Derek Robertson are still the creative team on The Boys, even though the artist is different, and that's what makes them a team.
I was going to say, I think a really good example of how writers and artists working together and then conversely not working together is 52 and Countdown.
Mm, yeah.
You had your writing team for 52 and Keith Giffen doing breakdowns for the entire series, but never having to actually draw in detail any of the issues. He could break it down. He had that universal eye for setting the camera and that kind of thing, and then handing it off to whoever is going to be doing the actual finish work. And I think that was a great example of how writers and one artist could work as a team to help build that book. And then you see Countdown, where they totally threw that idea out the window, and, you know, you get Countdown.
Oh, boy. Yeah, well, hey, at least Countdown's over.
It's done, yeah.
Well, and to be the converse for that, that's why I'm looking forward to Trinity so much. Because you're going to have, yet again, an artist-writer team. You're going to have Kurt Busiek, along with Mark Bagley, however the hell you pronounce his name, you know, together on the title, giving consistent work every time. Just along the lines of 52.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that, to Trinity, because of that.
Right. Brent, let's go to you on that.
I was going to say 52, and, like, you know, we had a couple issues by... you know, we had the regular team of Olaf, Joe Bennett, and some other people, you know, and then you had an issue where, like, Ken Lashley came on or Derek Robertson came on, and it totally threw me off when those guys came on. It wasn't the regular team. Mm-hmm. Even though it's great that those guys came on and do the book, like, they threw off the whole feel of the book, because I've been used to this kind of consistent art style. Joe Bennett, Olaf, and, you know, so those other guys all had a similar art style, and then when you throw Derek Robertson in for, like, the... that last issue where Ralph Dibny died, you know, so heavily inked, you know, and it looks like it had been drawn on, like, gritty paper, just threw it off. Even though that was the feel of the story, I hadn't been reading Ralph like that for the whole, you know, 52 issues. So I think there's an idea where you had good writing, you had good breakdowns, but you had the artist, and he just threw you off.
Yeah, no, and I'm with you on that, because there were some artists that came in and still managed to do well on 52, like Jamal Igle. I know that I think if memory serves me right, he did one or two issues, and it still felt like it was an issue of 52, as opposed to when Derek came in, and it just kind of felt off. But
even Phil Jimenez popped in for like an issue mm-hmm. or a half or something, didn't throw it off that much.
Yeah, right, and that issue worked incredibly well, because that was supposed to be one of the, I guess, midpoint issues that was supposed to be like incredibly important. And, of course, it's important you bring on a quote-unquote epic artist like Jimenez to draw the issue, and it's going to work.
Now, if only he could have done all seven of Final Crisis, or Infinite Crisis.
Oh, but he did in the trade.
No, see, the Ivan Rice stuff is still in there, though.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I looked at that trade the other day, and there's a couple pages where he does add some new things, and they actually colored that red splash or whatever that was terrible. When it first came out, I remember getting that. The fuck?
It was like getting a blown up thumbnail sketch. Seriously.
Yeah, they put in extra pages, but they didn't say, okay, redo the ones that you couldn't do.
Okay. Yeah, well, what are you going to do? All right, let's throw it over to Travis and then Sean.
I do and don't agree that the writer and artist have to be on the same page, because I think if you have the writer and artist 100% on the same page, then you're going to get, I don't know, not necessarily a stale thing, but, you know, if they're on the same page, sure, you know, you've got it. You got the idea solidified there between the script and the final page product. But at the same time, there's like some lack of creativity in there. But I definitely think there needs to be a communication there, because I've read a lot of interviews with a writer and artist team where the writer told the artist to do one thing, the artist did something else, gave it back to the writer, and the writer was like, holy shit, that's way better than what I was thinking. So I do think that, like, you know, it doesn't need to be 100%. You know, let the artist be the artist. And, you know, but sometimes they may need to be reined in, because I know I was reading something with Bendis and Finch for a new Avengers breakout. And Bendis would be like, all right, Finch, we got to go this way. And Finch would do something different. And Bendis would be like, that's not going to work this time. Like, we definitely need to do it how I said. But then other times Finch would give him something back that was different than what he said. And he's like, whoa, yes, you're completely right. We need to do it this way. And same thing with, like, Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee on Hush. Jim Lee would get stuff back, and Jeff's like, oh, you need to add in this or that. Or he'd get stuff back and be like, holy shit, this is way beyond what I was thinking. So like I said, I don't think it needs to be 100%, but there definitely needs to be a lot of back and forth communication. So that way, if, you know, say the artist does take it just a bit too far out of what it's supposed to be, the writer can pull them back in before, you know, the page is done and we get a product that may not be as good as what it could have been.
Right. Yeah. No. I'm totally with you on that. And I guess you would sort of have a little bit of an inside information on that. You know, working with collaboration the way you do on your own projects. I assume that there are moments where, you know, you change things or make additions that either work or don't. Right.
Yeah. I mean, me and Sean go back and forth on a lot of stuff, and
Sean pitches ideas to me, and I'll just be like, no, that doesn't work. And then I'll pitch some to him, and he's like, no, that doesn't work. And we both, I mean, we both have a, like, we're on the same page. I think where it counts, like, we both know what the story, what's good for the story. And we may come up with ideas on the fly that sound good at the moment, but when you bounce it off somebody else and they're like, no, you step back and you're like, wait, you're absolutely right. So like, I'll bounce an idea off of Sean that I think is good for a second until he goes, no, that's not gonna work. And then I realize he's completely right, and I just step back like, okay, well, how about this? And, you know, we work something out.
And when you do something that doesn't work, does he pat you on the head and say, there, it'll be all right?
He tries to.
It's actually kind of funny because I definitely. We do story together, so like we know where it's gonna go, and then we stop, and then he goes, go right, and I go right, and a lot of the times I'm the one like kind of scripting out the fights and doing the dialogue and stuff, and I'm kind of guessing, but also because I know Travis and I know his art, I kind of know where to go with it. But like it's kind of a guess of like how he's going to do something or how a panel is going to look, and I'll write something out to look one way, like, and I see it in my head. I give it to Travis, and he goes, "Yeah, that's horrible." And I thought I had some really good ideas a couple of times, and then he's just gone and been like, "That's not physically possible. My hand doesn't do that." But on the same page, like, he's wanted to, like, Frank Miller a character before. And I've said, no, we have to give him a human element. We have to give him emotion. You can't just have him kick in the door and say, I'm a badass. It just doesn't always work.
Oh, but it works so well for Penance.
Yeah, but that's Penance.
And by so well, I mean not well at all.
Oh, no, I understand.
Just making sure.
No, I miss Speedball. I really do.
Yeah, no, me and Sean both have had our characters where we've tried to go completely opposite directions, where I've tried to take character completely Frank Miller them, where they're a complete badass, and that's all they are. And he's trying to take a character and make it just too soft. I'm like, wait, they have to be able to punch people too.
Right. Yeah.
So we're good in the like collaboration as far as the back and forth. As far as being on the same page completely, no. But once again, I think that works out for the best because I really think that allows for the like most expansive creativity that you can get on the book.
Absolutely, because Travis, like, I mean, we're just two very different people. Like, Travis really likes to bring the technicality to it, the skilled. He's very passionate. He brings a table load of just. Technicality. He knows the art in and out, left and right, back and forth. When I write, I do it in spurts. It's very much about the emotion, and it's very interesting that when we collaborate, that we even get anything done.
Ebony and Ivory.
Oh God, no!
I'm the white guy.
This wouldn't be a sing along, please.
Whether I like it or not, it always becomes a sing-along on Comic Diamond.
But yeah, it's important to – I think it's important for the two to communicate more than, hey, here's the script, go draw. But at the same time, if you're both on like the exact same wavelength, you're going to get something that tastes stale.
Right, so something that just feels a little bit too polished.
Yeah. And in fact, I really think it's that realism, that little bit of grit that makes a good book. But yeah, you know, it's a completely different perspective, like once you start doing it, like actually writing and drawing a book. It brings up, I mean, like I used to read them and be like, hey, this is really cool. And now that I do it, I'm like, wow, these guys are horrible. And I'm not talking about us.
Right, of course. No, because you guys are awesome.
We are, God damn it. I'm Batman.
His parents are dead.
I like how that gets worked in now, even when Raph's not on the show.
Oh, God, I say it every day. At the store I work, you will go into a random book on the shelf. I work in a bookstore. And you will find somewhere that I have written in pen, my parents are dead.
Oh, it's disturbing. I found it behind the D&D books once.
See, now I'm just waiting to walk in, pick up a random Clamp manga, and just take it off the shelf. And behind the shelf, my parents are dead.
See, I don't do it in those because I refuse to even touch them.
Okay.
They burn.
Okay. All right, fine. Which reminds me, crap, I forgot to pick up my bleach at the library today. Oh, well.
You can just go to the store and buy it, you know.
Yes, but if I spend money on it, then I'm spending money on it.
I respect you.
It's like $3 at the grocery store.
No. Not bleach the product, bleach the manga.
You're talking about the manga, right?
Yes, I'm talking about the manga.
He's not talking about the thing that gets, you know, stains out of your clothes. He's talking about the thing that takes your humanity from your
I'm giving him a hard time.
Well, see, I just thought that everybody went to the library to buy bleach.
Yeah, because that's where we go.
Mm-hmm.
Yankees are weird.
Yes, but they won today. All right, moving on.
Bravo.
Right. Andrew's again.
Okay, good. Good, I'm glad I'm not the only one. So I was going to say something, and then it went away. Oh, here we go. I remember it now. Okay. So going along the lines of characters in comics, and I guess this will be the last thing we touch on before we go to movies and then the forum comments, but there are times when a character will completely shift. And again, this was brought up a little bit earlier in the show, but I want to go a little farther with this. Like, a total shift in character where it's almost unrecognizable to what it originally was. A completely new take. Would you rather see a new character or a new person with that character's name as the book when that happens? Or is it okay to take the character and the supporting cast and the powers and craft something new out of it, as opposed to just saying, oh, this is Blue Beetle, but he's a brand new person with a brand new cast? You know, you get what I'm saying? Like, a complete character shift, but still the same people in charge, or a complete character shift and a restart with a new character? Which would you rather see? And we'll start with John.
I'd like to see a character shift. People complain about characters not being the way they were. I think characters have to change all the time in order to stay interesting.
Okay, but sometimes a shift can be so severe where it's nothing like the original.
If it is so severe, then maybe they should have considered bringing in a new character. But I think a shift. I don't like the change that was ramrodded down for Spider-Man to have him be single again. Mm-hmm. But I think the exact same end result could have been achieved in a better manner. But regardless of how it happened, I think the shift is going to be nothing but positive for the character.
Right. Right.
So.
And going along the lines and actually sort of being an against for what I just brought up about, you know, keeping the name but, you know, adding in new characters, they tried doing that with Thunderbolts the first time they did it, when they changed the complete premise and purpose of the Thunderbolts book and made this is like, what was it, like a almost like a wrestling thing, like an underground wrestling thing with, like, supervillains and crap like that, that was totally different than the original premise of Thunderbolts, even though it was still called Thunderbolts, and people looked at it like, what the hell? Then again, it worked for X-Force for a while, where, the Milligan Allred restart, where they were called X-Force, but they were a totally different team, and even still had the same numbering for a while, still worked to their advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, I guess.
Yeah.
What about X-Factor?
X-Factor, yeah, X-Factor's true as well. And even the current run of Thunderbolts, you could even say that, because even though it's the same team, they're working for the government now, which was never really the case. The original premise of the Thunderbolts was as simple as villains masquerading as heroes, actually trying to do good, others not, and now you've got a shady government organization working out of Stargate headquarters. I'm sorry, I have to say that every single time. at any moment, Venom can jump and bite somebody's head off, and Norman Osborn is insane. You know, this is an entirely shift with only three characters from the original Thunderbolts team on the squad. But it's still technically the Thunderbolts. So you win some, you lose some, I guess. But anyway, let's roll to Sean here for the first one. Character shift or same title, different characters?
Actually, this kind of touches with a sensitive subject with me, as you actually already know. I'm really mad at people doing the same things over and over again. So a character shift to me is at least they're trying something new. Mm-hmm. Touching back to the Joe Quesada thing, I have so much nerd rage towards him. Oh, God. Okay, so you want to do a single Spider-Man? Let's bring Scarlet Spider back.
Yay!
There you go. Hey, that's pretty cool.
Well,
hey, that's an idea. That took me like 30 seconds of almost hard thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed seeing Spider-Man married. I was like, cool, this is a mature book. This is something different than when I started reading way back when. And now it's like, wow, really? So Joe Quesada's got something coming.
But moving away from the Quesada hate, because we always seem to get there on Comic Timing.
Yeah, sorry. I really like to see new things with new characters. I like the new Speedy. Well, I'm not sure she's still Speedy right now.
She's
Mia Dearden, right?
Yeah, she's still Speedy.
When they introduced her, I was actually really excited about her. You know, because I grew up with Roy. I'm a big Roy Harper fan. Great things for him. And then it's like they're introducing a new character to do the same thing. And I was okay with it. And I think they did a really good job with her. Same thing with Tim Drake. Who doesn't like him as Robin?
Exactly. Nobody.
Yeah. And then I liked how they tried to do the thing with Spoiler. And, I mean, I know it didn't work, but at least they tried.
Right.
You know? So change is good. I mean, we work in an industry read an industry that has got, you know, something close to like 80 years of just weight, historical weight behind it. And we're going to, like, as an industry, we're going to stagnate if we don't start bringing something new to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, new characters. Hey, Superman's cool, but let's see some other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can only do the same Superman story so many times, you know, because, I mean, they've done...
Yeah, eventually you're going to run out.
Yeah, yeah, and that's why, I guess... sort of returning Superman to his Legion of Superheroes roots was probably a good call by Jeff, because we hadn't seen that in so long that it feels new again. Even though it has been done before, it hasn't been done in, what, 20, 25 years now? So that's kind of why it works so well.
And into this generation of readers, which is, you know, I'm gonna call like us, that's completely new for me. I never read that old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, this stuff is great. It really is.
Now, as a counter argument, for example, you're talking about, you know, new things for new characters, which I'm totally for. DC seems to be doing that for some and not for others, which sort of annoys me a little bit. Example here. You put Red Arrow in the Justice League, which is great, lovely, very happy it happened. And then all of a sudden they decide to recreate the Titans out of nowhere. Even though
that sucks.
Yeah. Even though Nightwing has his own series, which works very, very well. Even though Raven was doing her own thing in her own place, appearing in Teen Titans from time to time, didn't really seem like it needed to happen. Even though the Flash has his own book, is in the Justice League as well. Yes. Even though Cyborg was, perfectly fine in the Teen Titans, and then went and tried to start his own Titansies, but didn't exactly work well for him. And even though Wonder Girl, now Donna Troy, was off in space with Kyle doing her own thing, they decide, let's do the Titans again. And it's just, I don't know, it kind of felt like some editor must have really, really wanted this so much that it's not really anything that I wanted to do. Let me actually, before I finish this here, let me actually outro John, because I know that he needs to leave. So I want to thank John for being on the show, man. It was wonderful having you here. Hope everything works out well.
Okay, sorry. Thank you, guys. I really had a good time, and I'll try and join back at a future date.
All right, man. Take it easy.
Thanks, John.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess...
Should we go to the Titans thing real quick?
Titans rant.
Yeah, Titans rant. Okay, let me go back to the Titans rant. In essence... It feels like something that didn't need to happen. They had all advanced past being on the Titans, and now they're back. So what the hell?
No, I completely agree with you. We've already got the Teen Titans.
we have the JLA. Mm-hmm. Why are these characters doing two things at once?
Yeah, the Outsiders too. Brent brings up a good point.
Yeah, the Outsiders too. I'm sorry, I completely forgot about that. Yeah, the Outsiders are good.
No, the Outsiders are great, and I mean, there seem to be two warring factions within DC right now, where you create new and interesting teams like this version of the Justice League we've never really had before, with a little bit of old and a little bit of new. And then you've got the Justice Society, which has a little bit of old and a little bit of new. And then Titans is nothing new. It's just old. So where does that fit into the scheme of DC in general?
I think DC really needs to stop holding on to these old ideas. They've got the iconic character, Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, all these, you know, the Flash. They need to start doing new things. And they need to really let go of these old ideas. They're going to get buried under their own history.
Yeah.
That's why Marvel whoops them year in and year out. I mean, we haven't really talked Marvel ideas, show a lot. Because they seem to be doing new stuff all the time. Keep talking about DC because they just keep repeating themselves. Like the Titans, they said, we want to recreate the George Perez and Marvel from Magic. Well, you can't recreate that because they're not on the book anymore. And having the same characters is not going to recreate that magic, you know, especially if you got Ian Churchill on art for the first issue.
Well, yeah, after him, at least it's Benitez, which is a little bit better, at least.
A little. I'm going to see how these next issues go and then take it from there. But I don't know if I don't think I'm going to stay on.
Well,
I think I have the budget for it.
Well, see, what I am happy to see, though, and I hope this is true, and this week's lying in the gutters. I know that Rich Johnson was mentioning that it looks like there is going to be a new Doom Patrol series, which I'd much rather see than this new Titans, because Doom Patrol can at least be new and exciting, because there hasn't been a new Doom Patrol book in a while, and from the looks of things, Keith Giffen will be the writer on it. So Keith Giffen, Doom Patrol, I'm on for, even if this Titans sucks. At least I can read Doom Patrol and be happy with the team book.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But anyway, let's go to the movies. Because I know that you wanted to bring that up at one point. Actually, before we do, let me just read up the forum comments real quick, just so we can get those out of the way. Jay Tomio had multiple comments here, but let's go to this first one here. I apologize if I'm barking up the wrong tree. The topic's still a bit vague to me. Well, the first thing that one subconsciously understands is that all comics, in a way, are like their own individual language that gets added to a whole to be used, tweaked, or ignored depending on many factors, one of which is commercial viability at a given time. It's not a huge surprise that our hosts are called what? I'm going to say comic timing here because he got it wrong.
He didn't get it wrong. I think he was saying comics have a language of their own, therefore the names of such shows, such as Comic Geek Speak.
Okay, so he just missed a couple of
words. I looked at that again after I wrote my reply there. Uh-huh. So I think he's just talking about how he said comics have a language of their own.
Okay.
Thus the name of the show, which is really kind of incorrect anyway, because, you know, they're comic geeks talking about comics, not because it has its own language.
Right. No, I get you there. But just he missed a couple words. That's why things were a little bit hard to understand. But I understand what you're saying there, Jay. So it was comic geek speaking. That's what you meant to say. But anyway, I'd also want to point out that much like literary theory, there cannot be one prevailing thought. Because while there are definitely things we could point to and give us a universal shared quality, there is a reason why it's called theory. So in science, it's close to truth as you can get, but I digress. And if one spent time, for example, in Rome and views a hypothesis about why comics are consumed, or goes on a train in Tokyo or suburban America, and one would, I think, come up with many deviations of the theory on what makes comics work to particular people, both as individuals and regionally, and how those expectations change the creative apparatus. Which actually does make a lot of sense. Comics are going to mean something different to a person in Rome than they would, say, in Cleveland.
Okay, so we'll change the title of this podcast to Comic Theory in America.
That'll work.
Like roaming.
What I think you will find is that comics, at least at the highest level, is true art achieved via an eye toward literary canon, but constantly being evolved and at times de-evolved by the pop conscious of the day and ideas of genre. I have some more thoughts, but fear that aforementioned tree looking at me strangely. Uh-oh, look out. If he was actually writing this in the car, then now I'm even more scared, and I hope that he actually survived. But, yeah, any thoughts on those thoughts there? Because he does make an interesting point, how it will be different to everybody else who looks at comics, you know? One comic is going to be different than to one person it would be to the next, both because of where you live and both because of, quite frankly, how you view comics.
Well, yeah, culture is going to affect that. Like, European comics, Japanese comics, American comics, they're all very different. And they all work in their culture for, you know, the reasons that it's that culture and it appeals to different things to different people. Sometimes I think people get a little carried away with that. One time somebody told my roommate that, my roommate was trying to tell him about Codename Power. And the guy was like, oh, well, I don't read that. The guy's like, why not? He's like, I'm European. And then, like, I mean, I understand what the guy was trying to say, but at the same time, to me, it kind of seemed like he was letting, at that point, he was letting, like, where he was from dictate what he read rather than, you know, expanding and, you know, trying maybe something else. You know, he's just goes, it's like me being like, oh, well, I don't read manga because I'm American. Like, you know, it's got caught up too much, I think, in his own thing instead of trying to branch out. So I agree, like, what me and Sean are working on with Codename Power may not appeal to the European people, and that's fine. But, you know, at the same time, like me personally, I'm not going to limit myself on what I read to just here or anything like that. Like, you know, it's expansive. And what I like is probably based more on what I've grown up with in the culture of America and stuff like that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's all. You know, there is going to be some universals through all the comics.
Right, right, yeah. And also going with what you said, it's very possible that you wouldn't have thought of Codename Power if you didn't read what you did.
Right, and as a matter of fact, a lot of Codename Power comes from Japanese stuff. You know, Power Rangers and Transformers and Voltron and, you know, all that kind of, a lot of stuff that came from Japan or cycled through Japan at some point has actually dictated some of the directions Codename Power has gone in, although it's kind of put through an American filter as far as the way it's presented.
Right.
So yeah. It's a little more acceptable to the American culture.
Yeah, no, I would certainly agree from what I've seen so far. But I'm gonna go with Ziggo's comment here, which will actually springboard us into the movie side of things, because that's basically what he posted. Since you said you'll touch on movie adaptations, I guess I'll touch on that subject since it's my better area of knowledge. Obviously, what makes comic books tick are a great collaboration between a writer executing his idea and having the right artist interpret it visually to express it. I think a great example is James O'Barr's The Crow. He really, in my personal opinion, took a fantastic story that showed how he truly felt when he lost his loved ones and just did such a great job in translating into a comic story. A while after, director Alex Proyas made a superb adaptation that kept the same emotion of it. I think to adapt a comic, as well as any other story, into a medium like a TV show or a movie, you need to obviously bring the heart and emotion of the story so that people can relate to it and so they can feel how people who enjoy the comics feel when they read it. To throw more examples, that's why Batman Begins and Iron Man work so well. Christopher Nolan gave Batman a realistic view and kept the emotion of a man fighting inner demons true to comics, and Jon Favreau translated Iron Man perfectly by tying our current modern political war view into the movie instead of keeping the old Vietnam War thing they had in the comics. And that's from Ziggo. Make sure to check out Comic Tube over at comictubepodcast.blogspot.com for more of his movie views. But actually, yeah, this does springboard pretty well into it, where he makes the important idea that it's more translating the emotion of the comic into the movie than making a perfect adaptation that's important.
Now, I'm going to go ahead and chime in. I do a lot of movie work myself, and one of my biggest complaints is I'm really tired of people giving movie makers crap for not translating a comic book movie exactly the way they want it to be. Uh-huh. Because people don't realize is, like, there's so many things that happen in comics, and as iconic as characters can be sometimes, as much as they have a distinctive look that everybody knows, everybody sees a character a different way. And that goes back to the art, because artists change out so often, the look of a character is constantly changing. Mm-hmm. But everybody still has that you know, image burned into their brain of how they think the character looks and acts. It's different for everybody. I don't care if you've been reading the book for years, you've been reading the book for like 2 days, you know, you've got a different image. And the director and the writers and the people who are in charge of the costumes and everything, they have this weight hanging over them that they have to get it exact for millions of people. And that's impossible. They can't do it. They can only do their best. And Iron Man is one of the very few examples of where you can take the look of that character and take it seamlessly from a comic book to a movie, because he's wearing iron armor, or, you know, if you really want to get technical, it's whatever the hell he said in the movie. But anyway,
gold alloy.
Thank you. But, you know, his armor plays in, it can play in a comic book. It can play in a video game. It can play in a movie. It's always going to look the same because it can. The X-Men's costumes cannot. You know, you can't throw somebody in yellow spandex up on a big screen and expect it to look cool.
Aww, you can't how come? Put Batman. Come on, man. I would have loved this.
Well, unless it's a porno. But you can't take, like, Batman, for example. You know, the only time I've ever seen Batman's costume done right, straight out of the book, is Batman Dead End, which is an indie film.
Yes.
You know, and they're the only people that really did the costume great. And I'm not saying that, you know, the costume Christian Bale wore wasn't good, because it's fantastic. But it can't be a literal translation, so they've got to change stuff. They've got to update it, because a lot of these comic books were created back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. They had different viewpoints back then. The movies now are being watched by people who grew up in the 90s, you know, and things like that. So they have to update it. They can't make it perfect. They have to work with a whole different medium. And I just wish people would give them more credit, because they're doing the best with what they can.
Yeah, well, and it's funny you should mention that, because the Joker, I'd say, is almost dead on to his typical comic book appearance here, at least his modern comic book appearance.
I definitely agree with you. I love the way they're doing the Joker. Even not his appearance, but the way he acts. He's psychotic again. He's not just the funny villain with a you know, rubber hammer and a Tommy gun. He's crazy, just like the Joker should be.
I'm sure we're going to get a similar psychotic nature out of Two-Face, because, well, he's Two-Face.
Yeah.
But actually, let me go to Brent on this. What makes a good movie adaptation from a comic book adaptation for you?
For me, it's all about the spirit. Like, I think Batman Begins and Iron Man have the spirit of the characters, but there, I'd call them a comic book movie, not an adaptation.
Okay.
An adaptation to me is Superman Doomsday, which was crap. Well, it was okay, but we reviewed that on a previous episode. And New Frontier is definitely an adaptation, and it's trying to be a direct adaptation. So for me, I expect direct adaptation, and that movie did not deliver for me. And that's I think Geeks Unite released that episode about it, or I had a lengthy diatribe on Raging Bullets 111 or 112 about it. Mm-hmm. But because I felt they didn't capture the spirit of it. It seemed to me that that movie captured the big action pieces of the film and then tried to string along a few scenes in between so that the action scenes would flow. Whereas if you read the book, it's all about the characters and the spirit and the feeling and stuff, and the action scenes aren't really the main set pieces of the book. So I just think they lost it there. So I think your definition is wrong. I think if you're a good comic book movie is different than a comic book adaptation.
Okay. All right. Well, then, you know what? We'll go to movies next, then. Let's go to adaptations first, because there have been direct adaptations. There have been 300, for example, was almost an exact direct adaptation, and Sin City was a direct adaptation. But then you've got comic book movies, even going with, because you said the spirit like seven times in your answer. So right away, of course, I thought of Frank Miller's The Spirit. Because, well, that's Will Eisner's
The
Spirit.
That's adapting a direct story, though.
It's not a direct story, right. That's a movie.
That put that in a movie.
Yeah. So there are two separate categories for comic books. And I guess a lot of times, if you try to do an adaptation, you're going to fail. Because people are going to look for that perfect transformation. And that can't always happen.
I don't think it's as much as for your perfect transformation. I think a lot of it has to do with time and budget and what they want to do with it. Like, if you look at New Frontier and the first Ultimate Avengers, the first Ultimate Avengers movie, you know, they're trying to do Ultimates 1, which is 13 issues in 70 minutes, and throw in a little bit of, you know, their other stuff, too. And, and that was terrible. And the second one was a little better, but they told an original story. Yeah. Like, one of the main things that I said on Geeks Unite and in the Raging Bullets diatribe is that, you know, these animated stuff, I want to see original stories, because to me, that's what works in these 70-minute time frames. You know, the Iron Man animated in the Doctor Strange worked okay because they're animated, they told their own story. So, you know, 300 and Sin City had 2 hours to adapt stories. And Sin City told 3 stories in there, you know, almost 4 when they had that little section of the killer and all that stuff. So, but they had the time.
Yeah, but those were very cinematic books.
Right, and those were cinematic books, so that works. But Ultimate Avengers and New Frontier are limited to 70 minutes, and they're trying to put in, you know, 12 to 13 issues of story. And even, you know, I'm saying 12 to 13 for New Frontier because that was 6 double-sized specials, right?
Right.
So that's ultimately the same amount of pages as regular 12 issues. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of it has to do with vision, time, and budget other than intent.
Well, see, and then you go to stuff like Wanted, which takes the basic idea of the comic and goes in an entirely separate direction. A lot of it's still there. You've got the absolutely nobody guy who's brought into the secret organization and learns about his father and learns to be as good as his father was. However, as opposed to it being a supervillain organization, it's a crime family. And that's, sort of a totally different take than what was in the comic, but it's still the basic idea of the comic. So then you even go into, like, this third category where it's almost a comic, but not in the end. It's kind of weird, you know?
Well, like, and I think another example is the Hellboy movie, the first one. Right, you know, it tried to tell the story of, like, the first trade, I think, and it did some other elements, but I mean, you know, most of those elements were there, but at the same time, it's told its own story. And the next movie is totally off from itself. It's something completely new that we've never seen before. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that will be even better because it's going to capture all the spirit of all of the Hellboy comics that everybody loves.
Right. Let's go to Sean here. I know he had something to say.
You have to get away from doing stories that have been done before just for the simple fact that stories are directly affected by the medium and through which they're told. You have a comic book, you're telling a comic book story. You have 22 pages to tell a story. You have a movie. You now have an hour and a half to 2 hours to tell a story. It is a different medium. You have to respect it differently. You have to treat it differently. Same character, same everything. You just have to come at it from a completely different angle. And I think a lot of people forget that or don't know that you can't do comic book movies like comic books. For every good comic book you've ever read, how many bad ones did you read?
Oh, a lot.
I don't. Okay, exactly. So, all right, now if we apply that same formula to movies and do exactly like the comic books do, you're going to have how many bad comic book movies? Maybe. Can anybody say Howard the Duck?
Ugh. Hey. Dolph Lundgren. Okay. Dolph fucking Lundgren.
America.
Yeah, do you hear this?
Ian brought up the best worst comic book movie when he said Wanted. Thanks for that, Ian. I was hoping we could stay off of that.
Yeah, we hate that.
I will say that.
Okay, though, okay, like, well, go. It hasn't come out yet, so it could turn out to be a decent Angelina Jolie movie. I don't know.
It could also turn out to be
not going to be decent.
Yeah, exactly. But no, Wanted, like, movies like Wanted, and you're right, I think things like Wanted are in their own category, where they stripped it down to pretty much like what you would use as the pitch for Wanted and then rebuilt the story back up from there.
Yeah.
And like, I think it's going to do great with people that haven't read the comic because they don't know the source material. But I don't think that movie has any chance of standing up to what the comic was.
Yeah. Well,
because, like, friends of mine that have no idea that Wanted was even a comic have come up and like, oh, this Wanted movie looks good. Like, I've seen the previews for it, and I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, what the fuck's wrong with you?
And then, you know, I explained to them the original story and like the comic book, and they're like, wow, that does sound way better. I'm like, yeah. I was like, you know, they stripped it down to the absolute basic, like, one line you could describe the story in, and then rebuilt it back up there from with new characters, new cast, and everything else.
And there's no shithead in the movie.
No shithead, no fucktard.
Super Assassins, that sounds like any old, you know, comic book thing.
Yeah.
Whereas if you had the super villain take like in the book, that's something that hasn't been done in movies before and it hadn't been done in comics before, which is why that series is so great.
Right. Along the lines of Wanted, and I'm gonna actually mention a Daredevil to me as Along the Lines of Wanted, because you had the basic story of blind guy with powers, and then you took the story of Echo, and you basically replaced Echo with fucking Elektra, and you had Jennifer Garner play her.
Hey, ain't nothing wrong with Jennifer Garner.
Nothing wrong with Jennifer Garner, but she's not Echo or Elektra. So,
honestly, what do you mean the Echo? Because I read those issues. I skipped those David Mack issues because I just could not get through them.
The entire story of Daredevil were those issues, basically. The idea behind Echo is that she is a girl whose father worked with the Kingpin.
Yeah.
And then Kingpin, you know, gets her to say, hey, Daredevil's the one who killed your father. You might want to go kill him. When in reality, of course, Kingpin killed her father. That's the idea behind Echo. I recently read the David Mack stuff. I loved it. So I think you're totally wrong, Brent. But what else is new?
And, well, the David Mack stuff I skipped was the collage crap.
Oh, okay, yeah. So this is before that. This is the one
it didn't
that
be that. This is that.
Yeah, this is volume two of Daredevil Marvel Knights. With David Mack writing and Quesada on art.
Right. I did read those. I was thinking the collage crap. I did not read that. Okay. I didn't get through that.
Okay. Did you at least enjoy that?
Yeah, I did. I did enjoy that. Okay. You're right. Now, I do remember that. That I'm funny because I can't speak tonight. And because when I read that recently, the Daredevil stuff mm-hmm. that you're talking about, and then it did not remind me of the movie at all when I was reading it until you brought it up.
Okay.
I'm like, oh, I see the light.
And now you realize that Daredevil is a lot like Wanted.
Well, in bad comic movies, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. You know?
I'm going to play Devil's Advocate. I kind of liked that movie.
I liked it when it came out, too, but it's nothing like the book.
No.
You could almost go V for Vendetta, even though that's an awesome movie, in my opinion. Because, like, you read that book after seeing that movie like I did, and it's totally – there are some elements that are the same, but it's a lot longer and a lot more in-depth.
Well, that did what we were talking about. That took the spirit of the book and managed to capture that well enough. Made it similar to how Iron Man did it, where made it, I guess, more in tune with today's times and managed to do a good movie out of the source material, even though things weren't perfect – it still turned out to be a good movie.
The V movie sort of there's one part they changed that they probably really shouldn't have. I mean, it's a great movie, don't get me wrong, but it definitely gave me an incest vibe because in the book, you know, he's very much a father figure to her, and then suddenly she's kissing him.
Ooh.
In the movie. It's a little weird.
Well, don't you know that they can't make movies without love relationships? Oh, wait, Iron Man.
Well, there was one in there.
Kind of.
Really small, but...
Well, come on. Hey, I'm just happy, okay? Because I thought that they were going to go that route with Iron Man. Because the way that Quesada was, like, throwing it up, it was like, at New York Comic Con, he said, oh, yes, Iron Man was wonderful. It was the best love story ever told. And I'm like, oh, crap. Please tell me they did not hook up Pepper with Tony. And I saw the movie, and they didn't. They seemed to just be in, you know, the friend zone, which is perfectly fine by me. Stay in the friend zone, because that's what Pepper and Tony are. They seem to still be on that route. So they managed to do a comic book movie without introducing a love relationship, which was a plus in my mind.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. 100%.
In the comics, have they ever hooked up?
No.
She's married to Happy Hogan.
Wait, didn't they hook up very, very briefly during Boozy X run?
No.
No? Okay.
Sean's an Iron Man fanatic, so go with what he says.
Okay. All right, whatever you say.
They almost did.
In the Iron Man movie, did you notice that John Favreau is the bodyguard and his name's Happy?
Yes.
No, John. Hogan. They actually called him Hogan.
Yeah.
Happy, whatever they called him. But I was like, that's Happy Hogan. Why the fuck doesn't he get like a bigger role?
Well, he probably will in the next movie.
I just thought it was cool that I was like, that's Jon Favreau. And then they called him Hogan or whatever. I was like, ding, ding, ding.
Winner.
Yeah.
But yeah. But yeah, just going back to the general idea, because you know, swinging things back to theory, just in essence, what do they need to do in a movie to make it right? What do you never want to see in a comic book movie ever again after the failures that have happened versus the positives? So yeah, let's go that route. What failures do you never want to see in a comic book movie ever again, other than bat nipples, because that's a given.
Brett Ratner.
Yes.
And Brett Ratner, although I kind of dug X-Men 3, so I'm just going to take myself out of that, I guess.
Ian, man, you gotta stop saying stuff like that. Lose respect for you by the gallon.
Okay. If you take it for what it is, it was okay. But if you take it as a sequel to X1 and X2, the Bryan Singer Vision, then it's nothing.
I thought it was going to be terrible, and it was adequate.
Honestly, I'd say what I don't want to see in movies anymore is... they're trying too hard sometimes, you know, they're like throwing things in that they think the crowd wants to see, but we don't. They're throwing things in where they know we want to see it and we do, but they twist it to the point where it's just not right. You know, do what feels right for the movie, make the movie, give us the nods that we want. Like in Iron Man, when Rhodey looks at the armor and he's like, next time, baby, you know, little stuff like that's great, but don't push it. Don't overdo it. And don't try too hard. Do it if it feels right.
Do you have an example of overdoing it?
Off the top of my head, I can't really think of anything.
Spider-Man.
There's a few things in Spider-Man, but I really wish I had an example. This is a conversation I had the other day, and I had an example, and nothing's coming to mind. But there's
the monkey back on. Enough said. Do you like Italian? Enough said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just Ghost Rider, the special effects were great. That's all I can say about the movie.
You know, I watched that movie for one reason and one reason only, because the one scene where him and Sam Elliott are riding through the woods or through the desert. I mean, that was epic, seeing the two Ghost Riders together. Other than that, it was crap and Nicolas Cage needs to die.
Yes, before you can name that a child, Kal-El.
I watched Con Air the other day, and that retard he plays in Con Air is exactly the guy he is in Ghost Rider. It was ridiculous. Same shitty accent and the same shitty like brains and stuff. It was terrible.
Ugh. Yeah. I'll honestly, like, the one thing I don't want to ever see again is an unfunny Spider-Man. Hmm. The fact that Iron Man was 10 times funnier than any of all of the Spider-Men is. Just completely ruined Spider-Man for me. Spider-Man, when I read Bendis' Spider-Man, I am laughing out loud and crying because it's amazing funny.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get Tobey Maguire.
Who's emo in the first one and just gets worse.
Travis nails it.
I'm sending you guys a link to a YouTube video that you need to watch directly after we're done with this. The Spider-Man 3 dance scene set to a Kids in a Hall sketch called Bim Bam Baby.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
That where the...
Those Canadians need to stop.
But, see, the thing is, though, the music works so perfectly that I actually would have been okay with this being the version in the movie.
Oh, God. But other than that, like, the unfunny Spider-Man's a problem, but stop pandering to the lowest common denominator. Make the comic book movie intelligent. Assume your audience is going to be able to figure out what's going on. The more you bring it down to the lowest level, that's how low the movie's going to be. Right. And that really bothers me. Like the Batman movies, the last two. The biggest problem was you had multiple villains, so you thought you would – the directors believed that they had to give them all the same amount of screen time. That doesn't work, you know, and they fixed that in the current Batman movies, and I'm really happy for it, but but they fell prey to it again in Spider-Man 3. And I just can't stand it.
What I want to see in... You could do. I guess you could do this maybe in Batman 4 or something like that or whatever, if no one is still on the property. I want to see Bane done right.
Yes.
Yes!
Because of how awful he was done in those first Batman movies, mm-hmm. where he was made a fucking sidekick, all right? When this man is the guy who
Poison Ivy.
Yeah, oh, Poison Ivy was terrible, but Bane was the one who broke Batman. And that could work so well in a Nolan Batman movie.
Yep, 100% agree with you. As a matter of fact, I was talking, somebody asked me what my favorite Batman villain was, and Bane. Because, you know, physically he's stronger than Batman, and mentally he's almost with Batman. So all in all, they're on a really good level with each other. He's an incredible Batman villain.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that they made him such a fucking retard in the Batman and Robin movie just makes me cry. He's just like... All he has is groans and grunts like, me lift bat signal. Oh, I'm badass. Dude, you're not the fucking Hulk.
But that's what they made him
into. The Hulk's smarter than that.
Yeah, the Hulk in the friggin' Eric Bana movie was smarter than that.
Oh, and
all he did was punch dogs.
What they did right in this Hulk trailer.
By the way, PETA was pissed about that.
Oh, yeah?
They had the car hands. That's what they did right.
No.
Yes!
No, what they did right in this Hulk trailer that they just came out with were those last bars. The last bars of music. Okay? With the da-na-na-na, da-na-na-na.
No. What they did right is they had Tim Roth go up to the Hulk and be like, that all you got? And then he just kicks his ass.
Yes.
And that's how you kick a guy in his shit.
That's awesome. I was like,
What I really like what they're doing with the Hulk movie right now, and one of my biggest complaints about comic book movies is they devote way too much of the movie to origin. The Hulk movie, like, they don't tell you. It's sort of a mystery that unfolds throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. Fantastic Four, it probably could have been a good movie if 95% of it wasn't taken up by origin and then one big fight at the end.
Yeah, which is why Fantastic Four 2 was a little better.
A little bit better, yeah.
The Silver Surfer carried that.
Yeah, definitely. But no, I'm so sick of the movies. It's like, we go to the movie, we know the character. Even if you're not a huge comic book fan, you probably know enough about the character to know how he became that character or she became that character. You don't need to devote so much of the movie to origin. We go to a comic book movie to see the comic book character kick ass. You know, or the inner turmoil of the character for, like, Spider-Man or whatever. And I don't care about how they became the superhero. I know that. I read the book. Give me the superhero.
Well, I was just going to say, the reason that they do the origin is for those people who might have never read a Spider-Man comic in their life. And there are plenty of people out there, especially with comics, comic movies like Hulk or Fantastic Four or Iron Man, which are popular within comic culture, but not outside of comic culture. That's why they do the origins.
I definitely see what you're saying with that, but it's like, I mean, you could devote a small portion of the movie to kick things off, but then there might be people who go to the movie, don't really know how it started, and then when they leave the theater, they're going to go pick up a book and find out.
I get you.
Yeah, it doesn't happen with everybody, you know, so you do have to have a little bit of origin in there to start things rolling, but don't devote so much of the movie to it.
Iron Man did it perfectly.
I was going to say, like, Iron Man, where they had, like, that whole big shindig for Tony Stark in the movie, and they, you know, in like 2 minutes they cover his whole life up until that point just by, you know, they worked it in the movie perfectly where it's like, hey, all these people at the shindig for Tony Stark, hey, here's all the things he's done in case you've forgotten, in which case, you know, and by doing that you explain everything to the viewer. And then as far as the process of him becoming Iron Man, they work that into the movie flawlessly. It doesn't feel like an origin story. It just feels like that's Iron Man becoming Iron Man.
Right. And actually, one other thing that I definitely don't want to see in a comic book movie ever again, I don't want to see another comic book movie without input from at least someone who has written a comic of that particular hero. And
that's why I'm really happy Marvel is doing their own movies now, because the studio that makes the comics is making the movie, so they've got that input.
Exactly. And that's why Iron Man works so well, because they brought Mark Miller, I know that they brought Bendis, and I forget who the third one was.
Warren Ellis and Addie Granoff.
Oh, okay, there we go. Okay, Addie Granoff and Warren Ellis.
The guys that did Extremis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they brought them all there to look over the script and make additions, and it's because of their input that this movie did not have the Mandarin in it, and that they actually brought Iron Monger into the first one, because he was originally going to be in the second movie. I think they made wonderful ideas and suggestions that I think, in essence, obviously, this movie wouldn't have been the same without their input.
Right.
I think Iron Monger really made that movie. Because you had, like, because it makes sense. He's a weapons developer. He's got this guy who likes making weapons, is doing backhanded deals. And if he all of a sudden stops making weapons and he faces a Mandarin, then what does that guy think? I mean, the whole corporate thing really worked well, I thought.
And he's the dude.
Yeah.
You noticed that too, huh?
Come on, that was a good rug.
They should make that a comic.
Actually, funny story. They might not have made that a comic, but John Goodman's character showed up in the Heroes Online comic.
Oh, that is epic.
Yeah, when they were at a gun store, I forget who was buying a gun, but it was John Goodman's character selling the gun.
Nice.
Yeah. Brent, I forget, did you actually mention what you don't ever want to see in a comic book movie again? Did we get to you?
No, you didn't.
Okay, so touch it.
Touch.
That doesn't sound dirty at all.
Touching it.
Poke.
Poke. With the poke on
Facebook.
Boop. Anyway, Brent, what do you think?
Shit. George Clooney?
Best answer ever.
Touche.
Seriously, I don't really know. I mean, I just want good actors in comic book movies. I don't want to see big stars in comic book roles unless they can actually do it. Like, Ed Norton had me a little weary, especially when I read that he's rewriting the scripts, like, midway through production and shit. And I was like, oh, man, this thing's just going to be a mess. Because he's an actor, he's well-known, he's, like, a big name, and he's rewriting the script. What does he want, more screen time or what? But from the looks of the trailer, it looks like he did it all right, so, and he's right for the part, so hopefully it'll be Hulk done right. But I don't want to see big names unless they're right for the part. Like, on the forum today and on comic book resources, they're saying Matthew McConaughey is Captain America. Please, fuck no. No,
I will stab everybody who ever says that.
Captain America is not from Texas, and you know Matthew McConaughey cannot get rid of that Texas accent.
There is only one person that I want playing Captain America. Matt Damon. Damon.
He'd make a great cap. But I think he'd make a great cap, though.
Yeah.
He's awesome in the Bourne movies, and he's a decent actor.
Yes, yes.
He's like the CIA movie. Like...
Yes, he does.
Yes, he does. He's got blonde hair. He's chiseled. He's hot. I mean, come on.
Yeah, chiseled it in a retarded clay kind of way.
Like, which is better than the last person who played Captain America.
Rogers is not a super genius, so...
No, they got to get somebody completely new.
What, David Hasselhoff?
No, like, I think for Captain America, it'll probably be best with the relative unknown. Like, Matt Damon wouldn't be too bad, but my biggest problem with Matt Damon is the same problem I had with Val Kilmer for Batman Forever, is physically, he doesn't fit the role. Like, he's, you know, he's got the acting credentials. Like, him, that he's proven that he can do action and all that from the Bourne movies. But physically, like, I don't feel like I could go stand next to Matt Damon and be scared of him. You know, Captain America, I'd walk up to him and be like, how you doing, sir? Would you like some money? You know, whatever I got to do to not get punched by you.
They can work on
that. Whereas, like, Matt Damon, I'd be like, hey, dude, you got a lot of money. Can I borrow some cash? Like, if not, I'll just beat it out of you. Whatever.
Well, look, Matt Damon just has me sold after that I'm fucking Matt Damon video. He could be in anything.
I'm fucking Matt
but
Damon.
Like, I mean, honestly, I mean, I do like Matt Damon, but I don't think he has the credentials to play a Cap.
Anyway.
But that's a whole other thing, though.
I think it goes back to, like, what they started saying about Brain Fart here. Michael Keaton, when he originally played Batman, I mean, he sort of proved people wrong, but a lot of the biggest things I remember from back then is people were saying, you know, Batman, aside from the costume, he's got a very recognizable jawline sticking out of that mask. And I think the same thing happens with Matt Damon, is his face in that mask would not work.
Okay.
Him as Steve Rogers, maybe.
Right.
But in the costume, no.
Give him – as a matter of fact, Matt Damon as, like, pre-Cap, like, you know, skinny Steve Rogers, like, trying real hard to be the badass guy.
Just do a totally different actor as real Cap.
Yeah. Just like everybody
we'll just
be like,
CG him up.
Get
it'll
Lou
be great.
Ferrigno to be Captain America.
Oh, Brent, go die in a fire. That's it. It's over, man. It's over for even making that statement. Well, for one thing, they have to pay him $20 just to sign anything.
Or Hulk Hogan.
Hulk Hogan,
Captain America.
Well, when I think Captain America,
say that again. I am going to hit you.
Well, when I think Captain America, I think Macho Man Randy Savage.
Oh Jesus! Oh yeah.
No, no, I'm looking for a real man. I'm thinking like China.
All right. Make Kira 90.
Well, if you're talking about the country China, I agree. You should just have the entire country of China play Captain America. I'd be okay with that.
I don't know if that's big enough to play Cap.
Well. All right, we're starting to go silly here, so I guess at this point it'd probably be good to get some final thoughts on everything. So let's everybody get their final thoughts on comic book theory in essence, and we could roll that into the comic book movie theory if you so desire. But we will start things off with Travis.
Like I said, once again, personally for me, like I know some people are really big on the plot of stories. Personally, I think characters drive the story, so you take a good character and you just put them in the situation, and like a lot of the best things for me has just been that like you have a basic idea what you're going with, but once you put the character in that first situation, just let the character do what the character does, and as long as you have good characters in the story, you'll get a good story. Let the characters, you know, react however they would. Don't force it, because you can tell in stories when somebody just needed a certain plot point to happen and they just force everything to that, and it doesn't read well, it doesn't flow well. As far as the writer to artist thing goes, you know, I talked about that with let the artist do the artist thing, let the writer do the writer thing, but neither one should stray too far from the other. And then just put out a good solid book with the good characters, good art. And then if you do decide to transfer your comic over to a movie, please don't copy the same story you had in the comic, you know, word for word. But at the same time, don't pull a Wanted and pull it down to your bare bones, then rebuild it. You know, keep what you have. Keep the spirit. The spirit is definitely most important to me. And that's, like, for my thing of what I never want to see in the movie again is the character that the movie's named after not to be in the story. Like, personally for me, Spider-Man. Spider-Man wasn't ever in any of the Spider-Man movies. You know, please carry the spirit over. Carry it all over. If you have to change something from the book, that's fine. And just, you know, as long as, like you said, the emotion of it is there, then everything's good. And the emotion should definitely be in the comics to begin with. If you don't have a comic with emotion, you're not going to go anywhere else from there.
Well, Spider-Man will be in the movies if Jake Gyllenhaal plays him.
And then he can...
That's actually a good choice, sir.
He can hop over to DC and date his sister.
Jared Leto.
Wait, didn't we figure out how he did that, though?
Oh, yeah, because Jake Gyllenhaal kissed Heath Ledger, and Heath Ledger kissed Maggie Gyllenhaal, so in essence, they kissed each other.
Awesome. Look at that.
Weird.
And now that we've all been thoroughly disgusted, over to Brent.
Actually, I do have some final thoughts this time. Oh, my God.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Who are you, and what did you do with Brent?
I think it's for a good comic book theory. You need a good story, good characters, good writer, good artist. You just need to have everything. And I didn't get to touch on this earlier about an artist not really talking to a writer and you can still have a good comic. I think a good example of that is Justice League of America number 20, Ethan Van Sciver, Dwayne McDuffie. I think I read somewhere on Newsarama or Comic Book Resources, they interviewed Van Sciver, and he said that, you know, he talked to McDuffie like last year in San Diego, said, hey, you want to do an issue? Yeah, sure. Who do you want to draw? These and these. And McDuffie sent him the script. Van Sciver drew it, and we have a great issue. You know, on the other side of the coin, we still have Van Sciver and Jeff Johns. Those guys work together, work great together. You know, Flash, Iron Heights, Rebirth, the Sinestro Corps one-shot, all great pieces of comic art. So I just think it can work on both levels. It just depends on the talent of the creators.
Right, yeah. And I'm all there. If you're going to have an artist draw something where unless you're specifically asking for stick figures, you got stick figures, you're in the wrong place. Just like if you got an artist that draws moody figures or you know, very colorful things when you're asking for dark and dreary, then you're in the wrong place. So you got to have a nice connection of everything. And if you don't have that connection, then I'm sorry, you fail. Please try again. And let's roll over to Sean for his final thoughts.
It's all about characters reacting in human fashion to extraordinary circumstances. That's what a story is. If you can do that well, that's a good story. And that's pretty much how I've always felt about good comic book stories and good stories in general. It's about people reacting to things that they normally don't have to. And it's about how they do it. And that's it. Be it movie, comic book. I mean, it could be, you know, freaking shadow puppets, as long as it's convincing.
I want that. I totally want a Frank Miller book with nothing but shadow puppets.
Hey, and if anybody could do it, it's Frank Miller.
An entire movie based on a comic book that's done in, like, the rendition of shadow puppets.
And those shadow puppets will be voiced by the likes of Morgan Freeman. just get, like, every, like, big name in Hollywood to voice those shadow puppets.
Or you can just get the guy that does, like, the Harry
Potter. Oh, I do have a question to ask y'all.
What's up?
How did you guys feel about Sam Jackson as Nick Fury?
Awesome.
Brilliant. Yes. Okay, good. Absolutely effing brilliant. I'm tired of these motherfucking Iron Man on my motherfucking shield.
I'm
especially enjoying the fact that they combined Avengers Initiative with Avengers. You know, let me tell you about the Avengers Initiative. That's just off the hook. That's it. Problem solved.
Yep.
Which, of course, will eventually lead to the second Avengers movie, which will be Civil War. All right, moving on over to Andrew.
My final thought really has nothing to do about comic books because I have a dirty mind. But I do want to add one thing that... I'm probably going to get slapped for saying this because I've said it so many times, but when he pulled up the record for the SR-71 Blackbird, the record for it.
He thought of the band.
Should have said SR-72, the X-Men's plane, and that's my final word.
And yes, that would have been perfect. However, I believe the rights to the X-Men are still with Fox, so that fucking sucks.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that's everybody's final thoughts. And, first off, let me just say, pleasure having you guys on, because you're awesome.
Thank you. We know.
And why don't you go and pimp Codename Power to your heart's content?
Please. All right,
that's enough.
Codename Power is our comic. It's American Sentai. So think people in colored outfits, giant robots fighting zombies that eat babies. It's good stuff.
Check out the website, codenamepower.com. Join up on the forums. Chat with us. We're crazy. We're fun. We don't censor anything. So.
And working on inks for issue 2 and pencils for issue 3.
Yay.
And we have good story.
Yes.
And some people think good art.
There is good art.
I'm some people.
Personally, I didn't think you were that fat, Ian, but whatever.
I'm going to go ahead, Ian, and I'm going to say you're number 2, aside from Travis.
Thanks for calling me shit.
Well, I guess Raph would have to say his good art because he was moaning and groaning and coming all over that sketch you guys got in my MegaCon Superman and Juggernaut.
It is definitely good art.
Did not hear the end of that.
If anybody out there can find an original copy of the first Codename Power issue, which you will never be able to do, please pick it up because it's giant robots that look like teddy bears.
We're not kidding. We actually had somebody bring it up to us.
Oh,
I'll
really?
Pay you. Earn it.
Wow.
I really will. And I got rid of all of them.
Wow.
Except for one.
No, I'm saying I don't have any more myself. Oh. I don't know who has them, but there's 100 out there to be found. So good luck with that.
Well, hey, you can do teddy bears, whatever the fuck you want, man. But as long as you keep churning out art like that Wonder Girl you drew me, and I'm sold.
Hey, if you can get a hold of that Superman MySpace photo.
Uh-huh.
Throw it up on your forum, please.
I'm going to try my best to track this guy down.
Yeah, because that was good shit.
Yes, it very much was. All right, fellas. And obviously, the website is codenamepower.com, nice and simple. And the forums you can link to directly from there, so all's well and good.
We do take feedback. I mean, we listen to it, but we may not use it.
Yeah, I think they should all be teddy bears.
And that's why you get banhammered.
Codename Teddy Bear.
Codename Power. To explain it in two words, dead baby.
Exactly.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Brent, I'll roll it over to you because I probably already know your answer to this. What's up coming on BK's Bullets?
Did I just go over this like 2 days ago?
Yes. But guess what? It's a different episode.
No, I don't.
All right. Even though you said that you might.
When did I say that?
The episode before that
last
one.
Episode. I didn't say that last episode.
Yeah, no, you said it the one before that.
The one before that? Well, that's two episodes ago. That's not last episode.
Yes, I know, but do you have anything?
I can change my answer episode to episode.
No.
All right, well, you can find his old BK's Bullet stuff, and you got a comment. You actually got a comment.
I did see that. I was very happy.
Yeah, you
like feedback.
Usually the only comments he gets on BK's Bullets are from his mother, so, you know.
No. From half.
Hey, whoever listens, man.
Yeah. I wish my mom would comment on our forums. That'd be awesome.
I pay money.
My parents are terrified of my stuff.
Well, yeah, and actually by his mother I meant Raph, so it's fine.
So does that mean your grandparents are dead?
And it all goes full circle. All right, and from there, also RagingBullets.com for the DC BK's Bullets. The email address for Comic Timing is comictiming@gmail.com.
Wait.
What's up?
Shouldn't we talk about Invincible Iron Man number 1?
Oh, yeah.
Because it's coming up.
Mm-hmm. 22 pages on Invincible Iron Man number 1 coming up, and we'll have a nice cast of characters on that, I'm sure. Hey, Sean.
Yes.
Would you like to be on an episode about Iron Man?
Yes. I was waiting for you to ask me.
So
get Invincible Iron Man number 1.
Yeah, Sean will be on that episode.
And you're going to have fun editing that because every time he talks, you're going to have to fix the audio levels and turn them way down.
Fucking Iron Man!
Not loud enough.
Do you want me to do it?
No. Oh, God, no. God, no. Please, I have ears. I have ears and I need to keep them.
Yeah, I'm going deaf very quickly hanging around him too much.
All right, just by hanging around you guys at MegaCon, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Hey, it's what sells the books.
Pity me, pity me.
God damn it.
All right. Well, the email address for Comic Timing is comictiming@gmail.com. Don't forget to check out the forums over at thecomicforums.com, graciously hosted by Comic Geek Speak guys over at comicgeekspeak.com. We're proud members of the Comics Podcast Network over at comicspodcast.com and members of the League of Comic Book Podcasters over at comicbooknoise.com/league. Please vote for us on Podcast Alley. Please dig us on dig.com. Send us your iTunes reviews on iTunes and all the rest of the stuff. And you know what? Go to speakgeekspeak.com/comictiming to read some blog posts and all that other crap. So for Andrew, for Travis, for Sean, for Brent, I'm Ian Levinson, reminding everybody out there that there's always time for comics. And also joining us are our MegaCon buddies. We got Sean Cummings and Travis Fowler, Travis Earls. Why did I say Fowler? Travis Earls, you know why? Because I know a Travis Fowler. Oh, and that's why. You know, I just sent a letter off to a Travis Fowler earlier today, so that's why it's stuck in my head. All right. Anyway, let me say that again. Oh, great. We lost him in the middle of a sentence there. Let me get him back. And this is what happens when you use Skype. That'll happen like 5 or 6 times sometimes when I'm on Skype. So, yeah.
I prefer iChat.
Yes,
Paul. Apple fanboy, ching.
I'm on a Windows machine. All right,
I just had to throw that fanboy.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
You can almost feel like sort of rabbit. You feel the edges.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No. I was just agreeing with you. So just repeat what you were going to say before.
Oh, I did say everything I say is not important.
That's yeah, but I said everything. A little bit old, a little bit new. And then you've got, is everybody still there?
Yeah.
What the hell was that?
Just listening intently.
That was so weird.
Or anything.
It's like you.
No, because I just heard the Skype hang up noise twice. That was so weird.
Maybe it was kicking in from John.
Maybe, I guess. I don't know. I'm going to stop you guys here for 1 second. I got to grab another battery for this thing before it runs out. So I'll be right back.
Big call. Definitely not.
As long as it's on this time so we don't miss the whole first round like before.
So, hi, Brent.
What's going on, guys? You guys are in Ocala?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I'm in Orlando.
Oh, really?
O-Town, yep.
I thought you were, like, out of somewhere up north.
No, I go to school in Gainesville.
No, I learned my lesson with EverQuest way back in college, and I failed my art class because of EverQuest, thus losing the scholarship and pretty much fucking myself over pretty well.
Lovely.
Evercrack rules.
So my old roommate lost his life because of EverQuest. He was playing that for a long time. Did not have a social life.
I almost did. Luckily, I had winter break and went home and, like, you know, had little flings with girls and remembered life was good. Then went back to school and was like, you know, maybe EverQuest isn't such a good idea, and maybe I should actually do school. And so that's what I did. And then WoW almost got me because I got in this whole, like, minor depression thing when I got in an accident and lost my awesome-ass car. So I stopped playing WoW for a few months and then kicked myself back off of that to work on the comic again.
Stop getting in car accidents!
It was just the one, but I was so depressed over
that. In all fairness, he wasn't in the car accident from MegaCon. He was actually one of the people that came and saved our ass because we were stranded on I-75.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, which actually will be a story that'll probably end up in the back here. Coming back from Anime Boston, not this last one, but one before that, we take the Chinatown bus to get to Boston, and basically what the Chinatown bus is you get on in Chinatown in Manhattan, and it takes you to South Station in Boston. So it's about maybe $10 cheaper than the Greyhound, and it's totally shady. And the entire fucking thing is ridiculous. We used to take we used to take Feng Hua, which was one of the bus services. Now, when you think Feng Hua, don't you think safety? You know, it doesn't sound like something that...
I think
just,
feng shui.
Feng shui. But,
no, it's fun at first, and then you're going, wow, when you're driving off the cliff.
Well, okay, I stopped taking Feng Hua. Dude, I stopped taking Feng Hua after Columbus Day weekend 1 year. We're heading back from Boston to New York, and we're on the bus for 6 hours. 6 fucking hours without a rest stop. Because the guy went all the way through Massachusetts and went through New York State.
Fuck.
Yeah, as opposed
that's
to taking
like nowhere near Boston.
Yes.
Okay, we're gonna go from Florida to California through Canada. How's that sound?
Yeah, what a wonderful idea. So anyway, I stopped taking Feng Hua, so we took Lucky Star this time. And
yeah, I think luck when I hear Lucky Star.
Right. With Lucky Star, going there, we're perfectly fine. In fact, they even stop at this kick-ass Chinese buffet on the way there. So we stop, get lunch, and then we head there, all's well. Then on the way back, we're waiting to get on the bus. And the first bus that we are near, we decide not to get on because we wouldn't be able to sit next to each other. We're three people. We wanted to be able to get the same row. So we decided to wait for the next one. The next one comes, and they're getting ready to board. And eventually they say, oh, no, this one no good, there's a problem with the brakes, we're gonna have to get another one. We're like, oh shit.
What?
We wait for the next one, we get on the next one, and all's well and good, until we get to, I think we were in Connecticut at this point, we might have been near the end of Massachusetts before Connecticut. We get to this Burger King, where we stop, and we get food and all that, so we're like, okay, I guess they're not stopping at the buffet. So then the next thing they do is stop at the buffet. So this is where things go bad. Because, okay, why the fuck did he stop at the Burger King if he stopped at the buffet? When we get to the buffet, he says, the problem with bus, everybody off. We're like, what? What the fuck? He's like, no, the problem with bus, everybody get up. And right away, the first thing I do is I turn to my girlfriend and I go, yeah, that's great. Why the fuck did we stop at the Burger King? Because, you know, we ate Burger King thinking that we wouldn't be stopping anywhere else. So we're here at a Chinese buffet full with nothing to do but sit. And the guy tells
good
us...
Good job, you guys.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So anyway, we're sitting there. Mind you, it was a nice day, so we didn't even give a shit that we were sitting outside. But we're sitting there until the guy says, yeah, well, this bus is out of commission, so you're going to have to wait for the next one. We wait 2 hours for the next bus. Luckily, there's a supermarket in this little, like, shopping center, so I'm able to grab some sodas and some Klondike bars. So we just, you know, just chill out and just play some DS and just, like, relax for a bit. But yeah, we were sitting there stranded for 2 hours waiting for another Chinese bus to show up.
Hey, Ian.
Yeah.
Why don't we never take public transit with you? It sounds like you have shitty luck.
Kyle Reeves, like step off or onto any of those buses?
No. No.
Okay, because that would have been, like, the bad sign.
At least Lucky Star isn't one of the ones that got involved with the Chinese Mafia.
That's true.
Because that's a bad thing to have to say, Ian.
Yes, I know. I know. And we're out.
Ian.
Yeah.
Do you do auctions? Because, wow.
Dude, I've been doing that for the last 2 years. I have it memorized.
Good job.